Please repeat after me. I'm not here for me.
I'm not here for me.
I'm here for the people that lent me their power in exchange for a promise.
I'm here for the people that lent me their power in exchange for a promise.
I will keep that promise to make decisions with their interests in mind.
I will keep that promise to make decisions with their interests in mind.
I will vote after knowing the facts, not before.
I will vote after knowing the facts, not before.
I will use Robert's rules for their purpose, not my own.
I will use Robert's rules for their purpose, not my own.
I will oppose ideas, not people.
I will oppose ideas, not people.
I will think before I speak, not speak just to think.
I will think before I speak, not speak just to think.
I will take the job seriously or not take the job at all.
I will take the job seriously or not take the job at all.
I will represent my fellow students' interests, not my own.
I will represent my fellow students' interests, not my own.
I am not here for me.
I am not here for me.
Please have a seat. A couple other things before we get into our first presentation for this evening. One thing that was brought to my attention, and this is something that Kat can put on their first, their next meeting agenda item, is that some counselors have been live streaming the council meetings according to standing orders, unless you provide the speaker with notification. I think it's 24 hours prior. You actually cannot live stream meetings. So again, this is something that Kat can certainly take a look at and have a very hot debate over, because I'm sure lots of people are very excited about this particular topic. I really am. All right, with that out of the way, I think we've gone through all of speakers' business, so we'll go into presentations. We'll start with presentation item 2A, KPMG's audit findings, presented by Councillor Hammond and sponsored by Councillor Hammond. Is there a seconder to this presentation? Councillor Patches? Vice President. Sorry, my bad. It's that fresh looking haircut. It throws me off. Is there anyone opposed to this presentation? Seeing none, before I call Councillor Hammond up, just for all the proxies and all the new councillors, if you have any questions at any time about what's going on, if you feel lost, please just raise your hand, make a point of parliamentary inquiry, and we'll do our best to answer your question. I'm hoping at the next meeting we can do a quick refresh on Robert's rules, depending on how many presentations there are. I didn't want to overload you with four presentations, because that's a lot. So hopefully we can get through that at the next meeting of Students' Council. So with that, I'll call Councillor Hammond up to do her presentation. Give your PowerPoint.
Okay, hello Council, and welcome new councillors. It's really exciting to see some new faces and all the spots filled. So thanks everyone for your time today. Just here to present the audit findings that KPMG found when conducting their audit over the past summer. So just for some context, what an audit is it's basically just a review of that your financial reporting is giving a good and accurate picture of the financial health of the organization. So they didn't actually present the financial statements to us, that would be like the profit or loss, but they just reported to us if the profit or loss that we report is accurate and that all of our financial statements are giving a good picture of our organization's health. So with that in mind, I'll just go ahead and explain what they found in this summer's audit. So they completed the audit of the following financial statements. So there's two different ones. First, they completed an audit of the Students' Union and of the Students' Involvement Endowment Foundation. So these are two separate financial statements that they took a look at. And so as a preview, I will be putting forward a motion to approve this audit report today. The reason that I think it's appropriate to vote on it the same day is because nothing contentious was found in the audit report. There was actually only two minor corrections in the whole thing. It was, as KPMG said, a very boring year for an audit, and boring is good. And so with that in mind, they were also, the earliest they were able to present to us was October 7th, and the Students' Union has to submit a report to the Canada Revenue Agency by October 31st, so it is quite imperative that we approve the audit report today. And as I said before, there's nothing too contentious in it. So they focus on four main areas when taking a look at the accuracy of our financial reporting. And a big one is the completeness and accuracy of the inventory and cash sales in our SU businesses. So every year they take two businesses that the SU runs at random and selects them and does an inventory and cash count just to make sure that everything is being accurately recorded. So the businesses don't know before time that the KPMG is going to be coming and doing an audit. And this year they did one for Daily Grind and Submart. And then the second area of focus is just making sure that there's an accuracy in the accounts payable and the accrued liabilities lines of the budget, and the accuracy of the University of Alberta student loan. So that's that loan that we took out on the south side of the Students' Union building to kind of expose the basement and put in that nice glass. So we got a loan from the University of Alberta, and it's just checking that all of the expenses with respect to the loan are being recorded accurately and fairly. And then finally, just the accuracy of the investment income, which I believe is mainly pertaining to the CEF fund, and just making sure that all the investments are being recorded fairly there. And so after they took a look at all these areas, they're satisfied that everything was being recorded accurately and appropriately. And so the next part of it was the results of the audit. In the Students' Union financial reports, there was actually no adjustments needed, so everything that was recorded was actually recorded very accurately. And then in the CEF fund, there was only two minor reclassification required that basically just had to do with the income from the investments in that fund, and it didn't have like any impact on the net financial statement. It just was basically a reclassification of the costs, or sorry, the income into the correct category. And so all of the reclassifications were reclassified, and then there was no differences that remain uncorrected. So like they said, pretty boring year because there was essentially nothing to correct it other than that minor thing with the CEF fund. And then they did come away with a couple recommendations, and just keeping in mind these are simply recommendations, so the Students' Union doesn't have to implement them, but they are just doing their job recommending some minor changes. And so the investments, they had a recommendation for the reconciliation of investments, so that was to do with just changing the inconsistencies that were found with that CEF fund. And then they also came away with a recommendation of posting of journal entries. So journal entries are basically how an organization records expenses and income. And so right now there's four people that do it in the Students' Union, but they recommended that it's reviewed by a senior personnel and that all of the journal entries are allocated to that one individual. So while keeping in mind that these are recommendations, the Students' Union isn't compelled to institute them, and it's not really necessary at this point because there was essentially no errors in the reporting anyways. So those were just some things they had to take away that they have to report to us, but overall they're really satisfied with our financial reporting. And so once and if this is approved by council, they will release an auditor's statement that will accompany the financial reports. And so this auditor's statement basically just certifies that the financial statements that we release are complete and accurate and fairly represented. I'd like to open the floor to any questions and may defer some questions if they're out of my league, but I hope that I was able to put that in plain English and welcome any questions you have.
Are there any questions for Councillor Hammond? Seeing none, great presentation.
Thank you. For the longest time, I wasn't ejecting my USB and that could have caused so much damage.
All right. So with presentation item 2A out of the way, we'll move on to presentation item 2B, an overview of the historical issues seen in residence, presented by Vice President Gosain and President Rahman, sponsored by President Rahman. Is there a seconder to sponsor this presentation? Council Farouk, is there anyone opposed to this presentation? Seeing none, I'll yield the floor. He said the presentation was
not too long ago, yes.
Yeah. The reason we're here is that we've been talking about residents a lot, and I don't suspect that we're going to stop talking about residents. So many councillors want to have, you know, more context and more historical knowledge so that we can put a little bit of perspective around everything that we're saying. And so here we are today, and I think that this will help us be on the same page for the rest of the year. And I hope you enjoy this presentation.
Residences have been on the radar for the Students' Union for quite a few years now, and we're going to go pretty far back, in fact, almost a decade back, way back to 2007 or 2008. And that's where we're going to start our review of issues that have come up for residences, because that was a really big year when we signed an important document with the University of Alberta. And then there were some really prominent changes that came as a result of signing that document in 2012. So quite a few years down the road. And then we're going to take a look at basically every single year from 2013 to this year right now. So, to kick it off, over in 2017, the really important thing to note here is that the Lister Hall Students Association, as well as other residents' associations on campus, were jointly student groups, and they were jointly employed by the University of Alberta. So the University of Alberta collected fees on behalf of these associations for these groups so that they could pay their executive salaries and run programs and provide services for students at the end of the day. And they did so on the basis of them being employees of resident services, as well as student groups on campus who registered with the SU's SGS, and then later as a resident association or a student representative group. Now, in 2007, 2008, that's where we saw a lot of issues coming up around alcohol usage in residents in particular. And the university always loves to talk about best practices, and so they took a look at a lot of their comparative schools, like at UBC and U of T and McGill, and especially in the Ontario area, where you've got not just the U of T, but you've also got Waterloo, you've got Western, you've got tons of other campuses that have different policies. But if you take a look at Ontario, they have one blanket policy that says if you have primarily first-year students in residence, you're not allowed to have that, like that residence must essentially be dry. And the U of A took a look at that policy and figured that might be a solution for the issues that are coming up over at the U of A. Now, one thing that they forgot to consider was the fact that the drinking age in Ontario is 19, whereas the drinking age in Alberta is 18. So it's not always clear how you can copy and paste best practices from one jurisdiction to another without taking those into consideration. And that's something that the SU and the other resident associations flagged. Now, we weren't really coming to consensus on what a best alcohol policy was. And as a result of that, we signed a draft memorandum of agreement, or sorry, not a draft, it was finalized by the time that we signed it, basically saying we agree that we're going to work together to resolve what an alcohol policy and a couple other issues in residence should look like.
Okay, now we jump a few years ahead. Consultation was ongoing until 2012. And both the LHSA and the SU and the university described them as quite unproductive because, as Fahim said, we couldn't reach any agreement when it came to alcohol and other policies. So what happened after is that there were four changes made in residence or residence life particularly. Two of those changes were fairly benign, we're going to say, and the other two were very heavily opposed by the LHSA and the Students' Union after they were implemented because there was no consultation done whatsoever. So an example of such change would be to transition Classic Lister into a first-year residence and to prohibit alcohol consumption in common areas. So when we did flag that there was no consultation done on how that was implemented, after a lot of back and forth with the university, we did sign a student consultation protocol. So that is, unfortunately, we still refer to it to this day. The university paid a lot of money to get that protocol developed, but unfortunately to this day, to kind of bring us back and draw some lines, it is still not used, and it's quite forgotten.
There's a couple other things that I want to draw to your attention. First is the fact that there was consultations from the period of 2007 to 2012, and both parties described the consultation as unproductive. But in the summer of 2012, the university just announced four changes, two of them to be implemented immediately, and that's the changes to the student-staff employment structure, as well as the change to alcohol provisions in the Lister. And they basically said, consultation's not going well, we're going to do what we want anyways.
Yeah. Okay. So basically, these two changes were introduced on something called the President's Emergency Authority Clause. But we still didn't agree with that, and we saw that it was completely inappropriate and out of the blue that these policies were implemented.
Now we'll take a look at the individual policy changes that were proposed. Mm-hmm. And I really want to emphasize point number three that's on the slide right there. Changes to the student staff employment structure. Because there were issues around how student groups were operating within residence for quite a few years now. But the thing is, if the university ever said that there is an issue with how a student group is operating, a student group that the university employs, they would openly be admitting that they weren't managing one of their employees appropriately. But if you take a look at the change now that they proposed, now the resident associations are no longer employees of the university. They're completely autonomous student groups that if the university were to discipline, they could do so without any reprimand to their own institutional reputation.
And of course, seeing as this is a very convenient timing to start bringing up all these issues that we were flagging, you know, 5-6 years previous to this, we started seeing accusations against the LHSA come up in 2012, right after these policy changes. So, not to go into too many details, but I'm going to give kind of an overview of the complaints that we got, that were made against the LHSA. We didn't get them. So the first one was around hazing incidents and turnover incidents. And so in that same time period, while everything was happening, the university came up with a new definition for hazing. Now, it's quite vague. I think that we all agree that hazing is bad and the last thing we want to see in our residences or that we want to see our students do is that. But seeing as the definition was so broad and that these charges were brought not by specific students against the resident associations, but by the university against the resident associations, it all started getting a little bit clearer in terms of seeing that the university was really trying to exert some power and change the culture, namely the drinking culture that was in Lister. We're not saying that, you know, it was all roses and butterflies, but we also didn't agree with the very heavy punitive nature of the decisions that were made against the LHSA. So someone complains against the LHSA, a decision is made, and that says that you're going to be sanctioned now, but if anything comes up, or if another complaint comes up and you're found guilty of that, you're going to be suspended for at least a year. That was in 2012, 2013. We're going to jump to the third complaint that was brought against the LHSA. They were found guilty of that, what they were accused of, and so that triggered the first decision and got them to be suspended for 2 years.
So I just want everybody to pay attention to the timelines here, because the changes were announced in the summer of 2012, and then in December 2013, just over a year from those changes being announced, there's the first decision. And the first decision essentially says, this is the first strike, three strikes and you're out. And then if you fast forward a couple months, not even 3 months beyond the December 2013 decision, 3 months later we see a second one saying, this is the second strike, if you have another strike against you, you're going to be thrown out. And then 1 month later from that second strike being tossed to the LHSA, we have a third strike come. But that third strike was on the basis of activities that happened way back in 2012, before the policy changes were implemented. And so it really does look like retroactive punishment, or looking for a reason to find the LHSA guilty so that you can trigger that three strikes you're out clause.
Not to mention that in that last decision, what happened was that there was, of course, after the first and the second strike, the LHSA was very much aware of their situation and how vulnerable they were. And so at that point, they made it very clear to their executive that, there had to be some changes and some adjustments made to their events and how they ran things. Everyone abided by that, but there was a rogue member of the association who was really attached to traditions and basically refused to comply with what the LHSA had told them not to do. So what happened was they did something wrong, and when the president of the LHSA and the other executive members found out, they immediately fired that person, right? So they were conscious of that there was a mistake that was made, and then they took action to kind of fix it. But that wasn't enough for the university, and that triggered the first decision and got them disbanded.
So that takes care of 2013, 2014. We're now going to fast forward to 2015, 2016, which is the year that just happened. Now, despite the fact that the complaint was filed in, I believe it was April 2014, the results of that decision didn't come out until well over a year after, at August 2015. And in August 2015, we were notified that the third accusation against the LHSA would stick, and that would trigger the three strikes and you're out clause. Now, because of that, in August 2015, a lot of these student executives who were working as LHSA executives right then basically said, well, this is my employment for the entire year. What am I going to do if I can't work as the LHSA president, or I can't work as the LHSA VP of Events? And that was really concerning for the students' union, because students rely on these opportunities not just for leadership development, but also as a source of income or financial aid to pay for their residence experience or their experience here on campus. So it was really disheartening to us to see students essentially be taken away from democratically elected positions that they had earned way back in April.
Mm-hmm. They were also asked to move out of Lister, so it was not only a hit to their income that they were expecting or to the position and the valuable things that they were expecting to bring to the community, but also to their housing. Okay, so now there's a vacancy of programming and community building services and representation, right? So the SU feels like we need to fill this gap ASAP, right? Because students in Lister are not being represented. And basically, because that decision came in so late, there wasn't as much coordination between you know, the association resident services, so there's a big gap in events, services, and community life in residence.
I think the way that I describe it is it would be akin to the Business Student Association or the Engineering Student Society being evicted for 2 years on campus, and then engineering students or business students saying, well, who's going to run programs and services and represent me to the dean? I know the Students' Union could do some of those things, but it's not necessarily what we're as equipped to do as the Business Student Association or the Engineering Student Society would be.
Yeah. So what we try to do is have conversation with the administration to try and create some sort of association to represent these people. Of course, the SU at the time is told that this would be too similar to the LHSA, or they're not allowed because of the brand that the LHSA had developed. And so at that point, simultaneously, changes to the meal plan were starting to be proposed. And you can see how it's a problem when Lister students have no representation and a major, major change to their meal plan is being proposed. So at that point, we had to step in and act as the interim representative for Lister students. So with the whole suspension, I think it's important to be on the same page as to why we disagree with the decisions that were made. So as Fahim said, if it was the Business Student Association or the ESS or any other representative association, we don't think that students down the road have to pay for, you know, someone's mistake 3 years ago and not be represented. So the way that we see it is the university has the right to take away some of their privileges, to not let them, you know, have bookings somewhere, to not give them grants, etc. But it is on us to recognize them as representative associations. And so we don't agree fundamentally with the concept of the university disbanding a representative association or representative group.
I think that, in my opinion, it's a charter right for students to come together and associate as they see fit. It's up to you if you want to organize a chess club or a Lister Hall Student Association, because that's a charter right that's given to you as part of being Canadian.
Yeah. Okay, so now we've accepted that, you know, students can't come back as the LHSA. So the SU and the supposed to be LHSA executives come together and basically create a plan for what they think the future association should look like. They work with Discover Governance extensively. They start going through administration to see the feedback. So at that point, they started being pushed down for reasons that were, in our opinion, too micromanagey, such as the programming is too similar, or the executive structure is too similar to the LHSA, to which I say, well, you know, out of the 200 representative associations, probably 180 have the exact same titles and positions and you know, number of representatives. So it was all in an effort to kind of cripple the efforts of the students that were trying to get this association back on its feet so that people can be represented.
And there were a lot of back and forth that went between the Students' Union, the students trying to organize a new Lister Hall Student Association, and the Dean of Students' Office. So in October, they come up with the comment that the executive structure can't resemble the old LHSA. And then in November, they come up with the comment that the events can't resemble the old LHSA. And then in December, they'd say, sorry, we're not working during December. We'll have to get back to you in January.
Yeah.
And they keep on delaying and delaying and delaying the process until March, I believe it was 30th or 20th, 2016, where they say, we're sorry, you've got an event structure that works for us, you've got an executive structure that works for us, you've got a constitution and procedures manual and policy manual that works for us, but we don't have enough spots in residence right now because we have to guarantee them for first-year students. Now, it doesn't make sense to have a Lister representative association if they can't live in Lister. So again, it feels like the goalposts continually move. First they say your executive structure can't resemble the LHSA. Now you're saying we have too many executives in the organization for you to accommodate for. Mm-hmm. And so it seems impossible to work with the office in this matter.
There are also a lot of contradictory arguments being presented at the same time. So one day we'd hear that Why doesn't this association organize association? At that point, they proposed what I like to call like a mini or micro association, because they, you know, they were saying that there is no place for these people and that the association should be cut down to basically be a third of what it was supposed to be. So one day they're saying that maybe that association can organize things for all Lister and not a specific tower. And the next day they're saying, ooh, you know, be careful, because that's the workload on these people is very big. And so it was really showing that the arguments were, you know, getting more and more fabricated. Anywho, so after we made all these compromises, because at every step, the students' union never said, okay, we're not going to cooperate anymore. We always went back to the Lister representative, worked with Discover Governance, made changes to the structure of that association. But that was never enough. And I think the point where the students' union decided to withdraw their proposal because they thought that it just wasn't worth it anymore because of the compromises that were made, that association looked nothing like what the students wanted. So at that point, you know, things like we should have four different associations for every tower were being proposed, and even then the students' union was willing to compromise and consider that.
Which really wasn't something easy for us to, because for myself as students' union president, I think it's really important that students can sort of dictate what their student groups look like.
Yeah.
I think it'd be really strange if the dean of science told the Interdepartmental Science Student Society that you can't have a fourth-year counselor. You have to have a third-year counselor, because fourth-year students are graduating and they don't have as much of an investment in campus. It would be essentially an administrator micromanaging a student group to that extent, which completely falls contrary to my beliefs of students being autonomous agents that can control their experience with their student groups on campus.
Yeah. So by the end of that back and forth, students' union is told, okay, you have to have four different associations. We compromise on that. We consider it. We say yes. At that point, they hit us with, there's not enough spots for these people in Lister. At that point, the students' union withdraws the proposal for that association. Students in Lister are very, very disappointed, frustrated, and angry. They took their concerns and frustration to social media, and I don't know if you probably remember if you were around on Facebook around people who lived in Lister, but there were a lot of social media posts basically denouncing a lot of things, you know, beyond what happened to the LHSA, flagging things within the management of residences at the university and how they think it's not the best that it could be. So at that point, last year's executive, they talked to, you know, the president of the university, the administration, the dean multiple times. And so what ends up happening, not to take even more of your time, is the Residence Life Task Force is struck by the provost, Stephen Dew. You can find the announcement on the Quad, which is the blog for the university. So that was by the end of last year, I believe it was April.
Yes.
Of last year. And this is the task force or the committee that Fahim and I sit on currently. So that task force that you hopefully read about in our reports, that's what it came from. That's where it came from. So just to jump ahead and talk a little bit about what's happening right now, on that task force, we are committed to finding data and research to see what actually goes on, because the university has its perspective with the staff perspective. We have the student leader perspective. There's also a lot of intersection with RAs who are both students and staff. And so we found that the best way was to have a neutral third party look into what goes on in residence and come up with the data, the findings, and present it to the task force. Based on these findings, we at that point will come up with a series of recommendations that the university would follow to make residents better in the future. That's for all residences on campus. Now for the LHSA, the suspension, as we talked about, happened in April 2015 or March 2015?
It was
around that time.
August 2015.
So they are on a 2-year suspension, so they're supposed to come back this year. And we're going to be working with our Lister representatives and Discover Governance to basically come up with a proposal that would be accepted by everybody, and hopefully we won't have to make any of the same compromises that we were willing to make last year.
Which is why we went to council early in the year, if you remember. I believe it was either the first or second meeting in May. We said, "Hi, council, we need a motion for about $20,000 requesting that we can support the hiring of Lister representatives for students living in Lister."
Okay, one thing that is crucial that we forgot about was at the same time, so we were having these discussions with the administration about what the new association would look like and all that stuff. But in the middle of the year, I believe in January of 2016, so in the middle of last year, simultaneously with everything that was going on, residence services decide that they were not going to collect residence association fees anymore. And so we went from fighting the lack of representation in one specific residence, which is Lister, to a lack of representation that was going to be happening in all residences on campus, because we all know that, you know, eventually if these residences don't have a source of income, they can seek opt-ins, they can seek grants, but that's not going to be remotely enough for them to function in the way that they used to function and offer the same services as before. And so we perceived this as very much silencing the student voice and not allowing students to have representation. So you can see how that all added up and resulted in a lot of frustration that students decided to share in a very raw manner on social media. Okay, so we talked about the association fees. So that has been what we did after Resident Services said that they were going to stop collecting the fees, is that we went to the Board of Governors, which is the highest governing body of the university, and we got fees approved for four residences on campus based on the fact that they have mostly undergraduate students in them. But the change that was made is now these fees are SU fees. They're students' union fees. They're approved by council. Those of you who were here last year remember approving them, hopefully. And now they're approved by the Board of Governors. So there's really no way for the university to ignore that and not collect these fees. Or so we thought, right? So that was in May 2016. May 2016, the Board of Governors approves the motion to collect the fees from four residences. We hear nothing from the university until we reach out to them in very early July or late June, I think. We reach out to them, we don't hear very much back. A little chatter about, oh yeah, well, this, okay, thanks for letting us know, things like that. And then multiple issues started coming up, whether it was with FOIP and confidentiality and sharing student information, the dean being new, and all that kind of stuff. So
the most shocking thing that I heard was that a motion for the Board of Governors does not dictate that the university has to collect these fees. It gives them permission. So it's not necessary for the university to follow a Board of Governors motion. It's optional. They now have the option. That's what we were told in the meeting with the Dean of Students.
Right. So after that, we were asked to provide the proof that Students' Council actually approved these fees, which we did. They were ignored for a couple of months, at which point, you know, we started considering more serious options. We were kind of seeing no light at the end of that specific tunnel, until we continued our efforts and reached out to President Turpin and multiple people in the administration. And it wasn't until 2 weeks ago that... 2 weeks ago?
Thereabouts, yeah.
Yeah. 2 weeks ago that we got a definitive confirmation that these fees were going to be collected. So keep in mind that this is something that was approved by the Board of Governors in May and had a date of implementation that was on September 1st. So a month later, it was resolved after really 98% of the effort being made from our part. Okay, so that took care of the fees. Also the LHSA, or whatever it'll be called. Now for the meal plan. So the meal plan consultation is happening right now. And just a little bit of context. Are we out of time? Okay, meal plan, quickly. What happened? Meal plan. Okay, last year. So yes, last year a proposal of a new meal plan for Lister students was brought forward to a residence budget advisory committee where the previous VP Student Life / president were sitting. They're surprised because they had never heard of it before. They knew that no students were asked about it before except for, you know, a handful, and turns out many of them were employees of Residence Services. So what happened after that was the Students' Union flagged the lack of consultation, of course, and sent out a survey to Lister students, and within a couple of hours they got over 400 responses, and the overwhelming majority of these responses said that they weren't in favor of the meal plan that was proposed.
Can we get a motion to extend the presentation by 15 minutes?
Councillor Larson, seconded by Councillor Gnallahy. Is there any opposition to extending the presentation by an additional 15 minutes? Seeing none, please continue.
Thanks, everyone.
Okay, thank you.
So we sent out our survey to students, got a lot of feedback saying that students weren't in favor of the meal plan, and we essentially, unfortunately by that time, the internal governance process at the University of Alberta, that's Residence Budget Advisory Committee, Residence Advisory Committee, said, sorry, we already made our decision, there's no more time for consultations. Luckily though, they don't have final approval. The Board of Governors, because there's fees associated with the meal plan, needs to be the final approver for the proposed meal plan. Now, at BFPC, former President Navneet Kinda sends an email to the chair of BFPC saying, look, I've got a lot of concerns with these, and they're not just the SU concerns, they're students that are coming directly from students. I don't think that the Board of Governors should approve this because it'll negatively impact the student experience. And the Board of, the committee chair for the Board of Governors takes it very seriously. He says, you know, Nav, if there's a problem, give me a phone call right away. I'm traveling to Vancouver, but I'm always going to make time for student issues like this. And Navneet calls the board committee chair, is able to make him understand some of the issues that are going on. And ultimately, the board committee chair makes the decision to pull it from the agenda and say, the meal plan isn't ready for this year. There needs to be another year of consultation, which started in about September.
Mm-hmm. So this year, even though the university has had overwhelming proof or information that most students in Lister were not in favor of that plan, they still proposed the same plan to us this year. But at least there was some plan to do some consultation. So there are two town halls held, and there is a feedback form that is online right now. I can send it to speaker or send it in the WhatsApp chat, and please share it widely.
Widely.
So that kind of made it better than last year, but still not very good, because it showed that there is no substantial changes made to the plan after students were opposed to it. And so right now this is ongoing. We're hearing a lot of concerns, a lot of the same concerns that we heard last year around the overall cost of that plan, because it's supposed to cost $4,950. And it's supposed to be mandatory for everyone who lives in Lister, and there's no option for people to pick a lower tier or pay less than that.
So if you take a look at the meal plan as an issue, it's really similar to some of the other issues that arose in residence. There is student consultation or there isn't student consultation, but even if there is student consultation, it isn't necessarily included or incorporated in the final document. And then at the end of the day, someone in the university administration makes a decision to move forward against that, against the grain of what students are saying. And that's what we saw with the alcohol policies. It's what we saw with the employment structure of the LHSA. It's what we're seeing again with the meal plan.
So the consultation process is not over, and the Lister representative and myself met with individual from dining services, which I found to be very receptive to feedback. And so we're still working on, on the flexibility of the plan and the total cost. But it is really crucial that people actually contribute to the feedback form, because that's a direct path to the university. And it's not through us, it's not me saying it, but it's the students directly sending their feedback to dining services, which, you know, ultimately they have to negotiate or bargain on what the meal plan ends up looking like.
So that's the gist of our presentation. We tried to cover as much background as the issues in residence as we possibly could, but I'm sure that there are some places that we forgot because we tried to cover about a decade of advocacy within a 30-minute time frame. So we'll open it now for questions. We're more than happy to clarify any of the statements that we made or answer anything that we didn't cover in our presentation. Councillor Fruit.
Thank you for the presentation. It was very informative. Just going through the timeline, it seems that the LHSA seems to be disproportionately affected by resident services, or at least targeted. Have there been any other significant effects on other resident associations besides the LHSA, like specifically? I'll ask you a basic question.
Yep.
Thanks for the question, Councillor Fruit. I think the biggest thing that we've seen that impacted all the resident associations on campus was the change to the fee collection, because all of our resident associations rely on those fees from students that they have democratically approved through plebiscites or annual general meetings to run their budgets. And I'm sure you can sympathize, as you were very well versed with the Interdepartmental Science Student Society. If you took away the membership fees for ICE, you would be cutting their budget by about 80%. And so a similar action was taken with the resident associations. I'd say that's the most impactful decision that resident services made in opposition to the livelihood of our resident associations on campus.
All right, thank you.
So maybe just to add to that, just because I've been around since 2007, 2008, the other impact that it had on residents' associations is that Lister wasn't the only association that was affected by the alcohol policy. Every residents was affected by that particular policy.
Yeah. That's great. We'll take Councillor Mana and then the proxy for Councillor Andrew.
Okay, so it really frustrates me when the SU like strongly implies that the LHSA never committed hazing. So it often seems to me like the SU is erasing the harms inflicted upon students during hazing incidents. So I'm just wondering if there's a plan to kind of more openly acknowledge that hazing occurred in Lister and some of the harms that occurred because of that, because I think it's necessary if we're going to move forward with the reformation of the new Lister Association.
Absolutely. So I think the SU since then, we weren't, as I said before, we never, said that students shouldn't be punished if they were found guilty of committing hazing. But we have a fundamental difference in thought on how that should be handled. Because, for example, if you're part of a group if an individual is part of a group and that group is found to, have hazing in their culture, we don't think that disbanding that group is going to do anything, because the culture is still there, the people are still there. So when you want to sanction an individual, the university is free to do that and should do that. And these individuals should be held accountable, but based on their own, as individuals, as students. But the group cannot be disbanded, because that's how students are represented. And in that way, you'll be making students down the road, like 2 years down the road, pay for something that their predecessors someone in an association 2 years ago did. But that does not mean that we shouldn't look at that culture and the harms that were done and how to, you know, fix that. And so at no point in our negotiations or disagreement with the university were we saying that, you know, no punishment or no changes or anything should be done to the LHSA, but we were saying that there are more effective ways to deal with that situation. Education is a big component of that. And so just disbanding a group doesn't solve that problem at all. But it, you know, it's how do you make sure that that culture, it's restorative justice, basically. But there was no flexibility on that front. And it was either all or nothing. So it was either like you exist or you don't. But we're not going to address the root of the issue. We're just going to try to address how much people are drinking, not what they do when they're drinking, and how to respect one another.
Proxy for Councillor Angus.
Thanks for the presentation. In the presentation, you mentioned the price of the proposed meal plan. Could you give like the prices of the current meal plan just to give context about it?
For sure. Yes. So right now there are two tiers for the meal plan, and so one I believe is around $3,600. I hope I'm not mistaken. $3,600, and the other one is around $3,600 and $4,500. Yeah. So these are the two tiers. So right now, but they're declining balance, and so you have that much money, and then each transaction you make, the money is removed from your account, as you know, it works with your debit card and with other stuff. But right now, what's proposed is that students should be paying $4,900. By the way, within this $3,600 or $4,500, people could spend their money outside of Lister, so anywhere else on campus. So keep that in mind. And now the proposed meal plan is, the value of it is $4,950. $4,650 are only to be spent in Lister, and people have only $300 to spend outside of Lister. So they're calling that flex dollars. And so basically students move from having no restriction over, you know, where they could eat to having a restriction of you can only eat outside of Lister with $300. And that's not declining balance anymore. So every time you walk into the cafeteria and eat, nothing is taken out of your account. You're basically paying for an open buffet all year long, right? So I could go on, but I'm gonna, yeah.
We'll take Councillor Prock now, then Councillor Fruit.
So my question is not in regards to meal plan, but my general question is, why are the executives of the LHSA or the new proposed association paid? Because as far as I'm aware, no other executive at the SU besides yourselves are paid. So why is there a need to pay them?
So residents associations actually pay their executive. It's quite common. So in Hub, they pay their president around, I believe, $200 a month, or I forgot. But they do pay their executives. The idea is that it's not exactly our place to determine how a certain representative association should, you know, distribute its funds. So we can only do that through audit committee, because we are reviewing financially how they spend their money. But that's kind of a choice that they make, and we're fundamentally opposed to micromanaging their budgets. So if the students within that residence are, you know, agreeing to for their executives to be paid, then, you know, we don't see how we should be imposing something like that.
I think the biggest thing is we don't see it as the students' union's place to comment on how much pay student group executives should be receiving for their work. Because I sympathize, I myself was a faculty associate executive, and I almost put enough hours to warrant that being a part-time job, and I'm sure a lot of other people who have been involved with faculty associations can sympathize with that comment. And it does impact the accessibility of that opportunity. If you're expected to put in 20 hours a week into your role, and it makes it tough if you have to work a part-time job to afford coming to university in the first place. So we really don't think it's the students' union's place to comment on it. I personally wouldn't be opposed to seeing faculty associations being paid, but they'd have to work it into their budgets before making that happen. That's a problem that they need to handle. It's not a problem that the students' union needs to handle at the end of the day. Councillor Froop and then Councillor Larson.
All right, thank you again. The question I had related to, I guess, who has overseeing authority over residents' associations, because, as you said, I mean, like, you spoke about the charter, but even more so than that, the Post-Secondary Leadership Act very specifically says that only a student union has authority to grant representative status to groups. And using the Faculty Association example, while the university can take away our status as a student group, they have no authority to go anywhere, whether it be a faculty association. And that's very, very clear. And as far as I can tell, legally speaking, residents is falls within that scope. So I don't see how the university can presume that they have any legal authority to disband the LHS and LHS in the first place, unless they don't take that into court, which sounds like its own issue. But even now, with the fact that now that the fees that they collect are SU fees, that they're going through the SU and they're audited by the SU's audit committee, that they're accountable. In the future, how do you foresee who has authority over these associations and who can tell them what they can and cannot do in the future? Like, directly speaking, at least, not like withhold by withholding like rooms from them or whatever.
Yeah. So there are two things there. One, you're absolutely right. So the Post-Secondary Learning Act does say that we have authority to decide how we delegate our representation, and we choose to do that with faculty associations. And we choose to do that with residence associations. So residence associations are accountable to us through, they're accountable to us because of the fact that they're reviewed in audit committee, so like any other faculty association. But we actually do agree with the fact that the university doesn't or shouldn't have the authority or the right to disband an association because it's a representative association and because it's up to us to recognize it or not. And that has honestly motivated the students' union to address the root of the issue, and not specifically what happened with the LHSA, but how student group discipline is under the administration's purview. So, you know, we think it's something that the students' union should oversee, and it's how it's done with, you know, in many universities, and that's one of President Fahim and my goals this year as well.
Yeah. We've just got two people left on the speakers list, so I'd like to have a motion to extend our presentation by 8 minutes.
How long?
8 minutes.
8 minutes.
Until 7:10.
Sorry.
Councillor Froop, seconded by Governor Champagne. Is there anyone opposed to extending the presentation by an additional 8 minutes? Seeing none.
So we got Reed and then Colin. Sorry, Councillor.
Councillor Larson and Governor Champagne.
Okay, cool. I won't hog the floor, even though my question isn't so much a question. This is something that often really bothers me quite a bit. I'm sure people know me as somebody who gets quite riled up on this subject. I, unfortunately, was part of the year where the alcohol changes came into effect, and the culture, the idea of the cultural revamp of the space was given. So what I'm going to try and do is personify this a little bit and what the direct effects were on myself and my floor and my teammates, my friends, often people I consider family. So what happens when these changes come about, especially around alcohol, especially around getting rid of representation, is that you see a breakdown in how people go about conducting themselves in these residences, and then that behavior is blamed on culture or is blamed on the apparent lack of leadership, which I don't believe to be true. So what happens is you get people who get evicted. You get people who get scarily involved in alcohol problems. You get people who, in my circumstances, in a floor that was probably the strongest floor in Leicester, we won all of our tower events, we won every single small competition there's had to be. We flipped people's furniture and we partied really hard. You see that culture and that team and that family ultimately destroyed. You see 9 members of your floor evicted with no notice, with no representation. You see people get evicted for what used to be
minor offenses, drinking offenses. You see people hide their substance abuse problems. You see continuous problems that get worse throughout time and not helped because you only see policing and you don't see people there to help you. Resident services are some of my favorite people. I have fantastic friends. My partner was a part of that system forever, and these people only want to help. But when you have administration or policy, such as that we have now, you only see damages done because they can't. They quite often are limited in their ability to help somebody with substance abuse, or to say this is not the right process, or in the my circumstance, good friends who turn out to be SRAs who are silenced in their opinion about how damaging the system can be because they don't want to lose their jobs, they don't want to lose their livelihood, they don't want to be evicted, and they don't want to lose their homes. So this stuff goes pretty deep for me. And it's not just a little representation thing. As much as these people used to be the only people who would ensure that people who got a proper voice before they were evicted, got proper procedure before they were reprimanded, and wouldn't lose their homes. So when I see the university stepping up this process to removing fees for other resident services, or sorry, for other associations, it only speaks to me that they want these problems to be more universal, and they're not trying to find solutions between resident services, between students, and between these organizations that historically ensured that people are safe, that people have family, and they enjoy their home. Now, I'm not saying that I wasn't a problem child, and there wasn't many of those, but those people deserve the representation that these associations give them, and they deserve those supports. So, I guess to end this all off, and for a question, so this is a question. Has there been any data acquired as to how many people are evicted year by year without representation or without an appeals process?
I think the unfortunately simple answer to that is Resident Services doesn't share that information with us. Even when we were appointing our list of representatives, we asked for a copy of the students who were evicted from residences, and we weren't allowed to have access to that list.
There is an annual report presented at the Campus Law Review Committee. So the evictions are, you know, all together. So you don't see why people are being evicted, or you don't see the process. So did they appeal it? Did they not appeal that? But we do see a lack of an appropriate appeals process when it comes to fees. So people who, for example, break their contract are charged a $650 administrative fee. And a lot of people try to appeal that, and then the appeals process is not, one, it's not clear, two, it has, I think, quite an excessive burden of proof. And so it requires, for example, your physician to specifically state in detail why living in residence was bad for your mental health or if you had mental illness and so on. So I'd say the appeals process, regardless of whether it's used for eviction specifically, is not good and is not transparent. But for the evictions, we can look at the evictions that happened in Lister, and it is assumed that there is no representation there because there's no association. But for the others, we don't know how many cases the associations were involved in. We could ask. It's a good question, but we haven't.
Thanks for sharing your experience with us, Councilor Morrison. Really appreciate it. Got time for one more question. That's going to Governor Champagne.
Thank you. My question is for the meal plan. I'm just wondering what the next step is, because I looked at the slides and looked at the form. The form has a few questions, but it asks, do you have any questions or do you have any comments? But it never asks anywhere, are you in favor of this plan? Besides that, it's also called the Anytime Plan, which is super misleading because it's not an Anytime plan, it's anytime the halls are open.
Yeah.
And I don't know about you guys, but I didn't stop being a student at 10 p.m.
Yeah.
Or I didn't start being a student at 8 a.m. It's a 24/7 thing. So that's super misleading.
Yeah.
If in my opinion, if
If you can't have every single, if you restrict the eating space and you can't have every single customer in that eating space at any time, then you're lying to people. So what's the next step to, before it gets to the board, I'd rather not have to
say that up
to have this whole conversation at the board and have to show how stupid it is, because then everybody looks stupid around the table and no one wants that.
Yeah.
So how can we stop it before it gets to that point and actually create something students want? And I'm saying this by recognizing that the consultation, the consultants they hired for this have implemented this plan elsewhere.
Yes.
And I think I saw like 5 or 6 other post-secondary institutions. And they say they're non-biased and they don't have the financial interest, but I don't think it's too far of a stretch to say that their future financial interest depends on them applying, successfully applying this process here. So if that's not a bias, then I don't know what it is.
Yep.
What's our next step?
Okay, so 3 things you addressed there. Let's get rid of the easy stuff. So they recognize that it's not anytime dining, and I think the name change is, you know, pretty easy to achieve. I think we've been focusing a lot on the content or like the material. So the name change, yeah, you're absolutely right, and that's the first reaction that anyone who read this plan had. But I think it's a relatively easy issue to address. I do have a meeting with the Residents Budget Advisory Committee next week where all of these concerns will be brought up. For the second thing around, for the format of the consultation, something that I asked for and I'm yet to receive because there's some verification process that they have to go through is to receive all the data that was put into this form so that we, as representatives, can see what the students are saying so that we don't get the filtered content about what's in that feedback form. So that's the first step for me to see what students are actually saying. And if the concerns that we've been hearing, you know, through peers or through the Lister representatives are aligned with what people are saying in that form. I think there is also one issue that I didn't think was very well reflected in that consultation form was the following. So at some point over the past week or two, the idea of having the flex dollar amount, the $300, be an opt-in situation so that they could lower the cost of the meal plan, right? What that would mean is that students will see, oh, the meal plan costs $4,650, but they wouldn't necessarily know that they can only use that in Lister. So they would have to pay out of their own pocket to eat outside of Lister, right? So I think it's quite deceptive. I don't think it serves anyone any purpose because students are going to have to pay that money anyway. Might as well have that flex dollar component that's at least GST exempt. It might be $15 a year, but, you know. So the issue there, I see what's happening is that they're tackling, they're saying that they're tackling the issue of low cost, but they're really not. And what we've already asked for is that the bargaining be better with Aramark so that the actual bottom line of that meal plan be found and that students only pay that. So what we want to see is a reduced $4,650 and not, you know, removing the flex dollar component, you know, doesn't solve anything from what I've heard from students. So the next steps are getting all that information. And as we said before, it's not a done deal. So that will be something that's presented at the Board of Governors in December. So we've got quite a bit of time until then. So it's not a done deal, and all these things are going to be brought forward, but if not, we're going to have to come up with a different strategy.
Super. I did see a couple other hands come up, but I think that we have gone quite a bit over time. So I'll ask that everybody holds their questions until question period, and then front, VP Gosain and I are more than happy to talk about things there. Thanks, everyone.
very much. So that takes care of item 2B. Move on to item 2C, Resident Services Student Staff Unionization Initiative, presented by Councilor Monda, sponsored by Vice President Gossain and Councilor Larson. Is there anyone opposed to presentation item 2C? Seeing none.
Can you just get the presentation off the SU website?
Sure. You send it to Council Submissions?
No.
No?
It's on the website. Hi everyone. So also on the topic of residents, I'm here today to talk about the unionization initiative that is currently be going on with Resident Services Student Staff. So in case you don't know me, I know we have some guests and new counselors today. My name is Kyle. I'm a counselor for Faculty of Arts, but I've also been a resident assistant since May 2015. So I previously worked in Pinecrest House, and currently I am living and working in Hub. So before we begin, I'll just a little disclaimer to preface. I am not a legal expert. The labor law is complicated, and I may make some small mistakes just because, I'm not a lawyer. So if you need guaranteed accurate information on labor law, labor relations, all that type of stuff, you should refer to the Alberta Labor Relations Board. So over the past few days, you might have seen these posters. They've been causing a bit of a buzz on campus because they were posted in every single residence. And basically what it's announcing is that student staff filed with the Alberta Labor Relations Board to certify the Non-Academic Staff Association as their bargaining unit, so effectively forming a union. So to kind of back it up a bit, give you some background info and history, because I know not everybody is necessarily familiar with residence itself. Around 190 students currently work for resident services. The majority of those are resident assistants, or RAs. RAs are the frontline support staff for students living in residence. So they're responsible for everything from community building to health and safety issues, supporting students with whatever struggles they may have, as well as emergency response during on-call shifts. And then the other group involved, the Non-Academic Staff Association, is the union on campus that represents support staff. So that's nearly everybody who isn't a faculty member, so not including professors and those type of people. But however, right now, student staff members are excluded from the NASA collective agreement. So that means any position the university creates that can only be filled by a student is automatically excluded from the union. So that includes things like RAs, because to be an RA, you must be a full-time student who is living in the community you're working in. But there's also some other odds jobs on campus that also fall into this category, like library shelvers and a few other positions. Finally, while the SU represents us as undergraduate students, they can't interfere in labor relations. So which positions have applied to unionize? Here's an uncomprehensive list. So it includes all resident assistants, so that includes Lister, everybody in Hub, East Campus Village, Resident St. John over at Campus St. John also, and Missioner Park. It includes senior resident assistants, apartment assistants in Newton Place, residence life interns, residence programmers, Augustana RAs, and Augustana Hall coordinators. So the job descriptions and positions are a bit different over at Augustana, that's why they're listed separately. So in total, that currently equals, as I said, around 190 students, but this list is subject to change depending on what the Alberta Labor Relations Board rules. So right now, they're basically deciding whether the unit we applied as, which is resident services student staff, is valid or not. So the big question you may be thinking is, why would resident staff be unionizing? So everybody has their own reasons for signing on, so I can't really speculate as to that, but most fit into two major themes. That's representation and control over terms and conditions of employment. So representation is basically that student staff want a forum where they can get together, talk about what they like about their jobs, some concerns they may have, and work together to create solutions to these problems, as well as make sure the things they love stay awesome. as well as like students see the power of representation through the SU and they want a similar thing for the workplace. And additionally, it gives them control over terms and conditions of employment. So right now, because we are ununionized, the university / resident services has the ability to unilaterally change our terms and conditions of employment at any time. That can mean that they can change compensation, they can change our duties and hours required, that type of stuff. So when you unionize, you work together with the employer to create a collective agreement through a bargaining process. And once that agreement is ratified, it brings a lot of stability to the workplace because your terms and conditions are set out in that collective agreement. So to give you a bit of a timeline on this so far, in May, students started meeting with NASA, discussing some of the issues they might have been experiencing, and just basically finding out how this whole union thing works. In September, the petition signatures were collected for the application. So to apply to certify a union as your bargaining unit, you need at least 40% of the staff in that unit to sign a petition or union card. So on October 7th, that completed petition was submitted to the Alberta Labor Relations Board. And that brings us to today, where the Alberta Labor Relations Board is currently conducting an investigation into our application. So what's next? So as I said, the ALRB is investigating, and they've set a hearing date for October 24th. So up until then, they've assigned us an officer whose job it is to talk to the Non-Academic Staff Association, who I will refer to as NASA from now on. So they're going to talk to NASA, find out why they think the unit they applied for is valid. They'll also talk to the university to hear their side of the story, collect a list of how many people are currently employed and the positions we applied for. Basically, just collect as much information as possible from both parties, and then the board will either approve the application as is, modify the application, so that could mean that they change the positions that are included, they might take out some positions, really they could do anything, or they might deny the application. So they're going to, the hearing for our application is currently scheduled for October 24th, but that date is tentative. And the university has recently applied to move that hearing date back because they don't feel that they have enough time to provide the required information. But the Labor Relations Board has not decided whether they're going to grant that request or not. So as of now, it's set for October 24th, but that is highly subject to change. So then, if the application is approved or approved in a modified form by the Labor Relations Board, it'll go to a secret vote. So that means that student staff will get the opportunity to vote on whether they want to join NASA or not. And out of those people who vote, 50% plus one must vote yes to succeed, but it does not matter how many people vote in total. Finally, if the vote is successful, NASA will be certified as the bargaining unit for student staff, and then collective bargaining will begin. So if we are successfully certified, NASA is going to give student staff a labor relations officer, and it's this person's job to select a bargaining team from interested staff members. This will be a very open process. Any staff who want to be on the team can apply. The exact format of this is up to us if you want to do it election or just application based. Don't really know how that'll look yet. Then that team will work to consult all staff members on what they want to see in a collective agreement. And then they'll go bargain with the university. That process will go on for however long it needs to happen. And then at the end, the collective, once the university and NASA have agreed on terms, it will go to a vote. So all members will have the opportunity to vote on whether they think it's a fair agreement or not. And if it is successful, it'll be ratified and come into effect. So if you're wondering, NASA's role in this whole process is to represent us. They're not there to tell us what to do or anything. They're just there to kind of help us navigate the legal complexities of it all and just make sure that we have all the resources we need to be successful in the collective bargaining process. So you're probably wondering, why am I here today? Why does this matter to the students' union? So, the obvious one, this is a new form of student representation on campus. Pretty exciting stuff. secondly, an RA union representative could contribute to SU residents' consultations. So one option that's gone forward is that union reps could play a similar role as residents' association representatives on SU committees. Union reps would also be able to help solve problems that residents' associations might be experiencing and help connect them with resources. It would also help resolve some student versus student conflict that's been happening in residence. So over the past few years, a lot of RAs have felt like they've been placed in opposition to residents' associations and haven't felt like they've been able to work cooperatively with residents' associations. So this would give us a more clear forum to work out any conflicts that come up between staff members and associations and basically make sure that we're all working together to make the residents' experience as great as possible. And finally, there are many students on campus who work for the university and are excluded from NASA, like I mentioned. So I know that a lot of these students have come to talk to SU representatives about issues they might be having in the workplace. And NASA is a really great resource that you might not have known about that you can refer students to if they're interested. All right, that's it. Any questions? Oh, and also, I put some resources on here, so if you have questions about specific legal stuff or about unionizing other groups of student staff on campus, those are all really great resources to check out.
Thank you so much for the presentation, Kyle. I honestly believe this is the coolest thing that's happening in forever. In my belief, it's brand new. It's probably very interesting. It's also interesting because we don't have so much of a say as what goes on, which I think is super cool. You guys have got it done. On all of this, you did mention that although you can't give the reasoning for everybody else, I would assume that you're in favor of the changes. I was wondering if you would be interested in sharing your own reasons as to why you think you'd be interesting or why get involved in the process in the first place.
So I don't really think I should go into that in a presentation setting, just because I don't want to give the view that this is how other staff feel. So if you want to have a conversation about that afterwards or anybody, I would be really happy to do that. But I don't really want to get into that. No.
Thank you for the presentation. My only question was, you mentioned how there's a potential, for the SU, that union representatives can assist in, maybe managing conflicts between associations and resources, et cetera, et cetera. And I guess in some informal manner report to the SU about things that are going on.
Mm-hmm.
I understand that's not to replace risk associations, but more to complement them. Is this what you mean?
Yeah.
But could you clarify or respond to like the possibility that there can be inherent conflict of interest in that because you do, they do work with services. And it's in the union, it still kind of alleviates that to some extent, but like that can still be a problem.
Well, I think like the one thing that comes up a lot is that like this conflict between the SU versus resident services about how residences should be managed. And I think one important thing to remember is that both groups have the best interests of students and the student experience in mind. They just have different visions of how what is best for students. So I think that RAs especially, like, the reason they get into the job and the reason they do the job is because they want all their students to be having the best experience possible. So to, like, answer your question specifically, I'm not sure it would be a conflict of interest necessarily, but I do think a union would basically provide the forum for them to discuss problems they might have with any residence policies and create basically a solution from that kind of ground, like frontline staff level versus everything always coming from management.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions?
Oh, the other thing I will mention is that kind of putting them on the spot here, but we do have some other res staff in attendance here, so if you want to ask them, they might be willing to share why they think it's a good idea or why they might not think it's a good idea. I won't speak for them, but they are here. Yeah.
Okay, I'll ask it, even though I know you might not be able to answer.
Okay.
Having been around a lot of res services folk over the days and then had some inside look into all of it. Is there an opportunity for this union, you talked about terms of reference and the aspects of the job. From my understanding, RAs and SRAs, particularly, are some of the most overworked people I've ever met in my entire life. Is there an expectation that you guys would be coming into dialogue about fixing that issue?
Terms and conditions of employment are like what the main thing we're going to be talking about. So we're definitely going to be talking about compensation, making the job duties and descriptions more clear because right now it might not be as clear as it should be. I would say that like they're definitely going to be looking at compensation. We'll definitely be looking at hours and maybe structuring that firmly and like the main goal would be to like make it stable and make it predictable for staff members.
Any other questions? Seeing none, thank you very much, Councilor Lana, for that. All right, wonderful. So, one quick thing here. Item 7B will be moved up to take place immediately after recess. We've gone through 90 minutes of the meeting and have taken care of at least one item of business. So it'll recess for 15 minutes. Please reconvene back at 7:48 p.m. Thank you.
Yeah.
Very often.
I applied to the friends.
So,
I signed my MCA in September. So, I went on to the day of the game. Wait, man. I was in it for about 2 weeks before the year.
Yeah, it's just like,
We will move directly to item 7B. Blandon moves to appoint 2 members of Students' Council to the Council Administration Committee. Is there a seconder for this motion? Councilor Hammond. Councilor Blandon, would you like to introduce your motion? Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To continue what we started 2 weeks ago, Council Administration has 2 vacancies that we need to fill. Currently there is myself, Councilor Larson, and Councilor DeTirwa. We currently meet Tuesdays at 5 before Council for about an hour. And now I would like to take nominations to fill the vacancies that we have. Thank you.
Are there any questions for Councilor Flamin before we move into nominations? Yes, Councilor Christensen.
When was the last time the CAC met?
I think it was about 6 weeks ago.
Yeah.
6 weeks?
That sounds about right.
I think that's the number that somebody threw out.
I can double check. Just give me a second.
Are there any other questions for Councilor Flamin before we go into nominations? While Councilor Flamin finds that information, I will open the floor
September
to...
September 6th.
When was it?
September 6th.
So September 6th was the last time that CAC met. So now I'm going to... I'm going to open the floor to nominations. Yes, Councilor Kleiner, go ahead.
I would like to nominate Councilor Wang. Wang?
Councilor Wang, do you accept?
I would politely like to decline.
All good, no worries. We'll go with Councilor Nahi.
I
want to
nominate Councilor Hashim.
Councilor Hashim, do you accept?
I accept.
You accept?
Yeah.
I thought I saw a placard up here somewhere. Maybe not, so I'll go back to Councilor Flamin.
I'd like to nominate Councilor Yim.
Councilor Yim, do you accept?
I accept.
Saw Councilor Manda's placard up.
I would like to nominate Councilor Sunday.
Councilor Sunday, do you accept?
Sure.
This is getting exciting. Did you have another nomination?
That was mine. Did a proxy for Councilor Kim show up?
He did, but he just left.
Oh. then I retract my nomination.
Okay. Any further nominations? Yes, Councilor Larson.
I'd like to nominate Councilor Prock now.
Councilor Prock, do you accept?
Thank you, but not fam.
Any further nominations for the Council Administration Committee? Do the new members of Council have a good understanding of what the Council Administration Committee does? It's okay to say no.
I have a mandate, I'll read that out. I guess the extremely technical part of it. In accordance with Bylaw 100 of the University of Alberta Students Union, the Council Administration Committee has the authority to amend, adopt, or rescind the standing orders of Students' Council after initial set of standing orders have been adopted by Students' Council. Shall make recommendations to Students' Council on the structure of Students' Council and its standing committees. Shall oversee the Speaker and the Chief Returning Officer of the Students' Union. Shall oversee the progress of Students' Council legislative agenda, shall recommend to Students' Council a candidate for a position of Chief Returning Officer on or before April 15th of each year, and shall recommend to Students' Council a composition of the Awards Committee, which I thought had been delegated to Finance Committee, so that will have to... but basically, we administrate Council, TLDR.
So Council Administration Committee is also... sometimes referred to as the catch-all committee. Do all the stuff that other committees don't necessarily take care of. Councilor Larson, I feel like you have another nomination.
No, I was going to have a point of information.
Please, go ahead.
Okay. Just for sake of the nominees, there has been a meeting time set for immediately following council. That is to elect a chair, and it is the single agenda item. Also a reminder that all members of council are voting members of CAC and can participate in that vote. And that the current standing orders on our website are actually not, as I was informed earlier this afternoon by Discover Governance, are not the most up-to-date. Apparently there are some slightly edited versions that have yet to be uploaded. If anybody wants to see those, I did have them emailed to me at around like 5 o'clock today. So
what was that?
There's like a, like, it, those aren't quite the, whatever, don't worry about it. And that's about it. Yeah.
Thank you very much, Councillor Larson. Are there any further nominations? Seeing none. Okay. This is the exciting part. Okay, so, while I figure this out here. So, there were three members nominated and three members who accepted nominations for the Council Administration Committee. So, for all the new councillors, this is kind of how it works. If more individuals are nominated to a committee, then there are positions on that committee that are vacant. So three people were nominated, there are two vacant positions. So what happens in this instance is that individuals are, in the order in which they were nominated, must give a 1-minute speech as to why they feel they would be the best candidate or the best counselor to fill this vacancy, if that makes sense. Once that's done, council will vote. Based on that vote, we will fill those two vacancies. So, any questions on that before we get started with that process? Okay, great. Okay, so we'll go again, like I said, in the order in which individuals were nominated. So we'll start with Councillor Hashim. You have 1 minute. Go ahead.
Hi, everyone. My name is Mio. Actually, Mio Hashim. So I'm from engineering. So why I wanted to be like tech is actually I want to fill the vacancy left by Jason, actually. So I want to continue whatever he has done to this council and then try to learn as a council what I can do better and things like that. I have experience in administration, I guess from engineering society, as assistant vice president academic, and also administration as, because I work in the Office of Career Registrar before. So yeah, there's some experience in administration. So if you think I'm the best counselor to be in the committee, you work for me.
Thank you very much, Councillor Hashim. We'll go next to Councillor Yim.
So hello, my name is Emilia, and representative from Augustana. I kind of agreed to do this position because it's my first time at Students Union here. The year prior, I was the fourth year representative at the Augustana Students Association. And I have business managerial background. I've ran two businesses before, so I do have administrative experience. And I feel the best way to kind of get a feel of how everything works is just to jump right into it. So kind of learn as you go and kind of
great. Thank you very much, Councillor Yim. Last but not least, we'll go over to Councillor Sunday.
My name is Nathan. I'm from the Faculty of Native Studies. This is my first time on student council. I have no experience in administration. I'm eager to learn, but I'm sure the other two candidates have much more experience than I do. They'd probably be a better fit.
Why do you think you'd be good for the position, Councilor?
Oh,
gee,
I didn't even ask that. I guess because I'm eager to learn about student council, and I feel like I'd get a lot of experience.
Fair enough. Thank you very much. very much, Councillor Sunday. So what we'll do now is we will go to heads down, hands up style vote. Because I know that's everyone's favorite style of vote. So just to clarify before you put your heads down, you will each get two votes because there are two vacancies. Only vote twice. I'm not tracking you to see if you've only voted twice using the honor system. So everyone, including proxies, can vote. So for all of you who are voting, please put your heads down. So all those in favor of Councillor Hashim, please raise your hands. Thank you very much. All those in favor of Councillor Yim, please raise your hands. All right, thank you very much. And all those in favor of Councillor Sunday, please raise your hands. Thank you very much. Now, put your heads up. So, congratulations go to Councillors Yim and Sunday. All right, moving right along here. We will now go into executive committee reports. Do any members of the executive wish to make a report? We'll go first to Vice President Hussein. Go ahead.
Was not expecting that. Okay. So I'll start with something that I learned today that's very exciting. So we learned today that I got appointed on the provincial advisory panel for post-secondary mental health. So I hope that this will be, a great platform for us to share what we think best practices are and what we think students need. And what else did I want to say? That's it. I'm going to cut short.
Thank you very much, Vice President Hussein. We'll go next to Vice President Sundari.
Perfect. So first things first, I'd like to invite everybody to council to sub stage tomorrow at 10 a.m. Minister Schmidt's coming to give a presentation. He's making an announcement. We're not quite sure what it is, but he's saying that it's favorable to students and that it is a good surprise. So sub stage 10 a.m., please try to make it out there. That'd be great. Other than that, I had a meeting with the Chief of Staff for Minister Jerome Billis. That went well. We spoke about mental health, student financial aid, student employment, residence, and deferred maintenance. It was actually a really good meeting. And other than that, so MFest, the advisory committee applications are closing pretty soon. So far I've got 7 applications. If you guys are interested in taking part, if you want to help form the committee and you want to help really push this event forward, make sure that students have the tools and resources to help find employment, please apply. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Vice President Sundari. We'll go next to Vice President Patches.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. In addition to what was included in my written report, I put this in my written report, but I just like to highlight it. Please expect a presentation from myself and our general manager, Mark Dumashaw, coming up in the near future, most likely at the next meeting, if not the one after that, with another update of my reports the year. So we'll provide both an update on the planning and what pretty much been taking up pretty much all my time, which is planning the fundraising campaign. So we'll update council with that. And then I will also be presenting on the Students Union financial statements audited financial statements of last year, because I want to update council of that, as well as some explanation for some of the results. And then I would also like to pass on a message from our dear receptionist, Winnie-Dish Kitty. Governor Champagne, Councillor Keani, Councillor Hammond, Councillor Farouk, Councillor Newman, and Councillor Vickera, please pay for your sweaters. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Chicanti, for the amazing announcement. Thank you very much, Vice President Patches, for passing that along. Any other reports from the executive, Vice President Bannister?
All right, so I just want to highlight something in my report and throw a proposal at you all very quickly. So in my report, I've mentioned that there's a consultation going on for writing services on campus. This is very important if you write in any aspect of your degree or your peers write in any aspect of their degree. Because lots of students use writing services to help them get good grades and understand how to write in a more proficient way. So if you have an opinion on writing services at the U of A, whether you're an art student or engineer or anything between August and CSJ, you name it, please come to one of the two town halls. There's one on Thursday from 3 to 3:50 in ECA, and one on Friday from 9 to 9:50 in Humanities. So those are very important, and it's not just about the C4, the Center for Writers potentially merging with the Student Success Center. It's a holistic look at writing services. So please show up to that if you're interested. Also, I am considering having some half-day, one or two half-day job shadow days in the fall. Because as you know, lots of the executives always have that in the winter break before elections. But in my experience, many students decide if they're going to or not going to run for an executive position before then. So if you think that's a good idea, or if you'd attend a half-day job shadow day with me in the fall, let me know, and that will increase my likelihood to do that. And that's all for me, and yeah, questions are welcome.
Thank you very much, Vice President Bannister. We'll go next to President Rahman.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Just to build up on what Vice President Academic, just said, if you're curious about what a job shadow day entails, a couple of the meetings that the full executive have made it to since our council reports review were a consultation meeting with the Dean of Students about the Helping Individuals at Risk program. We also met with the Academic Staff Association, met with our counterparts over there to see some of their issues or highlights for the year. And then finally, we met with the Physical Education and Recreation Council of Students. Those are a few meetings that the entire executive board too were at. And then finally, VP Patches and I were at an MNIST meeting where we talked about how we'd like to see MNIST be reported. So not just getting one budget breakdown that says the Dean of Students spent this many dollars on student services, but instead seeing how much money went to particular student services and which ones might need an increase in funding or increase in other things in future years. The last thing I'll remind people of is that this Friday is the deadline to apply for the Alberta Student Leadership Summit. They're looking for applications from student leaders such as yourself, where you can showcase some of the lessons that you picked up as an undergraduate, and take a look at the Alberta Student Leadership Summit on our Students Union website, as well as Facebook, to take a look at that proposal. Thank you.
Thank you very much, President Rahman. That wraps up executive committee reports. We'll go next to board and committee reports, starting with the bylaw committee.
Bylaw committee hasn't met since the last meeting of Students Council, but we are meeting next week, where we'll be finishing up some of our amendments with editorial bylaw changes, so just typos and misprinted things. So that's one thing. Another thing that's kind of more exciting which I'm going to post right this second in the WhatsApp, is the vacancy petition system. A wonderful system that was created this year. My bylaw committee is now like up and about since the last election just passed, and so I just posted the link. There's two faculties with the vacancies, one of which is education, the other is physical education and recreation. If you have anyone there, and you have any friends or family or colleagues that are there that you want to share this with, they could join us through this fun new method of joining student council. We'd love to see it being used. So that's pretty much all. Our next meeting is on Tuesday, October the 25th at 6 p.m. sub 606. If you have any questions, please do let me know.
Thank you very much, Councillor Christensen. We'll go next to Vice President Patches for an update on Finance Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Finance Committee has not met since last council. His last Monday was a holiday, but we are meeting this next week, and we have two DFU annual reports to review to ensure that those DFUs get their finances disbursed. So, thank you. And we have, I don't believe I communicated that last council. We have set a consistent meeting time, which will be off council Mondays at 4 p.m. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Vice President Patches. We'll go next to Councillor Victoria Dion for an update on Policy Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. We haven't met since the last council meeting, so I have nothing new to report.
Thank you very much. We'll go next to Councillor Hammond for an update on Audit Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Not too much to report because I added it just as a report in the agenda, but I'll just cover that. Again, the KPMG presented their audit findings to us, which you just saw today. We also approved the Medical Students Association, the Business Students Association, and the Nursing Undergraduate Association. And we conditionally approved the residents, St. Sean. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Councillor Hammond. We'll go next to Vice President Bannister for an update on nominating committee.
So as I hope everyone knows, we are currently having our call for people to apply for GFC. So that is currently, that application is live on Jobkin. If you're from the faculties of ALES, Arts, Augustana, Education, Phys Ed and Rec, or Nursing, you have vacancies on GFC that you have an opportunity to fill. So please fill that out or encourage your friends, our peers, your colleagues, fellow students, your networks, your family, to fill that out if they're interested in serving on GFC. It really is a hoot and a holler. Deadline to apply is this Friday. Email me if you have questions. Or asking questions here again.
Thank you very much, Vice President Bannister. I'm going to skip the CAC update because there isn't much of an update other than CAC is meeting immediately following this meeting. So I'll open the floor to any other members of any boards or committees who wish to make a report, starting with Governor Champagne.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Board meeting on Friday, 8 a.m. in this room, if you want to come. The open agenda is, it's okay. A lot of reports, a lot of stuff to read. For example, the board chair's report is 33 pages, so if you have nothing to do for the next 24 hours and you want to read a lot of documents, you can do that. I read them diagonally unless they have student-specific issues that require more attention, but I would invite you guys to come to the open session. You don't need to RSVP, but it's a little early. There's usually coffee, though, so that's not too bad. That's all I have to report this time. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Governor Champagne. Any other members of any boards or committees who wish to make a report? Seeing none, we'll close board and committee reports there, and we'll move into open forum. So for those people who are not familiar with Open Forum is a period of 15 minutes in which guests of Students Council who qualify as current students, as current undergraduate students at the University of Alberta, have an opportunity to ask questions of members of Students Council. That's Open Forum in a nutshell. So are there any questions for Open Forum? Yeah, go ahead.
Does this mic work? Oh, it does. I would largely direct my question to you, Francesca. So a theme throughout tonight has been a significant power imbalance between resident services and both student staff and the students who live there. This may be my own ignorance, but has the Students' Union considered appointing some kind of residence ombudsperson position in light of Students Association being able to mediate the kinds of disputes that arise from evictions, et cetera. Is that a path that has been investigated?
Thank you for your question. So first of all, I think the initiative of unionizing is largely because we are not able to intervene or solve any labor disputes. But the Ombuds Service doesn't act as an advocate. They help you, or they help students navigate the system, if you want. So I think something that we have found, we've taken the role of helping students navigate that system, but I think the problem lies with that system because you have people directing you towards something that doesn't exist. For example, the appeals process is for, on fees, on evictions, all that kind of stuff. It's really not that transparent. And so I don't believe that that path has been considered before, but we've largely taken on that role. But it's a very interesting thought. So it got me thinking, so now. I actually wonder if there's a way of doing that. But there would still have to be significant changes made to how information around appeals and all that kind of stuff is communicated to students and to us, because we shouldn't have to send emails to inquire on something that should be public knowledge.
Thank you very much. Are there any additional questions for Open Forum? We still have 12 and a half minutes. So feel free to ask more than just one question if you'd like. Seeing none, we'll close Open Forum there. And we'll move on to question period. So again, just a quick tidbit on what question period is. Question period is a time available to members of Students' Council to ask other members of Students' Council questions about lots of different topics. As you can see, we have a couple of written questions. I strongly recommend written questions over oral questions because you get a much more informed and, I would say, complete answer when you submit a written question versus an oral question submitted at the time of council. So, before we get started, we had a couple of questions from Councilor Christensen to Vice President Bannister. Both, I believe, largely focus on the topic of GovWeek. Councilor Christensen, do you want to follow up on either question 6A or 6B?
Yeah.
Okay.
Good, may I?
Yeah, that's the reason I asked. Go ahead.
We didn't need that task. just a question to follow up on this. I was just wondering what the process around project allocation spending is and how decisions are made in that regard. Just to not only remind me, but also the people who might not know what those are. Because that's my understanding of how this money was procured or how allocated or whatnot.
So I'm going to direct that question to President, because it's not specific to kind of GovWeek. So.
Absolutely. So I think the context behind creating the project allocation budget line is the fact that as a council, we create our budget together, and we do that before the VP operations and finance, and the rest of the SU executive take office. And there's a lot of money that's allocated within the budget, but of course, it sometimes is impossible to incorporate new executive projects that arise within the budget. For example, GovWeek being a great example of that. GovWeek wasn't incorporated into the initial budget principles that council approved back in March 2015, but we still need to make a way to work for it, or make it find a way to finance a project like that, just because the VP academic campaigned on doing something around showcasing governance opportunities for students. So that's where the project allocation line comes in. Essentially, it's a pot of about
It's in the double digits for sure. It's about $40,000, I believe, $45,000 maybe. And that's allocated, that's dedicated to executive expenses for whatever initiatives come up throughout the year. And of course, that's not exclusively executive projects. There are times when our management has great ideas that require some funding that can't be fit from other lines of the budget. So we often dip into the PA line for that. But essentially, any decisions of the PA that cost less than $5,000 are approved by the executive committee. And any decisions that go above $5,000 need to be approved by council. So if there was a major initiative that the students' union was going to do, such as a get out the vote campaign that costs $10,000, we would bring that to the attention of full council, but minor projects that cost less than $5,000 are approved within the purview of the executive committee.
Thank you very much, President Rahman. So we'll go into oral questions that council has. Are there any oral questions for question period? We'll start with Councillor Nahid.
Would VP Sandar just quickly explain NFES to the new councillors?
Sure.
All right, so NFES is something I'm planning in February. It's going to be going on from February 6th to February 10th. It's going to be an employment festival, which showcases everything from speakers, events, workshops, cases, and anything that really has to do with employment. Now, what I'm doing is I'm targeting three different groups on campus. There's students early in the degree, students in the middle of the degree, and students at the later part of the degree. When it comes down to students early in the degree, it's more so about helping them find direction, figure out what it is that they want to do with their degree. When it comes down to students in the middle of the degree, it's more so about helping them build the skills that are necessary to help them be hireable and employable in the workplace. These are things like resume workshops, managing your social media, etc. And when it comes down to students late in the degree, it's more so about helping them connect with professionals. So this would be networking events, this would be career fairs, this would be kind of the meat and potatoes of a everyday average career fair. So that's the hope, is that the week-long festival will be a career fair plus. It will be a festival full of employment resources. Thank you. Apply for the community also. Do that. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Vice President Sundari. We'll go next to Governor Champagne.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is for, I guess, the President. Following the funding, infrastructure funding that came from the federal and provincial government, and I believe the conversation we had at council two meetings ago concerning should we start advocating for more funding from government, I started thinking about our own, the resources we have right now, and how government funds are spread throughout the institution. So my question is, would the Students' Union be open to finding out how much money is spent on student and the differences between the faculties?
Go ahead, President.
Sure thing. Thank you for the question, Mr. Speaker. I may defer to VP Sundari just because he was in a meeting with an AVP from Facilities and Operations where they have some of this data. In fact, I attended that meeting too, and I'm not too sure how much of that data was confidential. Some of it was, but definitely not all of it. So we'll get back to all of council and see how much we can share. I think it might be a little tough to distinguish between what's student space versus what's graduate student space versus what's faculty member space, because there are some places that are shared by a lot of members. But definitely if we can get some clarity on what space issues are a priority for students. For example, I know that not too many students use the research facilities down in RTF, for example. There's still some students, but definitely a minority of students relative to the percentage of graduate students and faculty members that use that space. But I think the big principle that I have is that within post-secondary education, the University of Alberta itself is a drop in the bucket of the entire provincial government's budget. So I have no problem asking the province for continued funding for projects that should be receiving funding, such as deferred maintenance.
Do you have anything to add?
Yeah, sure. Okay, so as Kim was saying, as President Rahman was saying, asking for deferred maintenance funding is something that is on our lobby doc right now. It is something that we are actively advocating for. When it comes down to it, we don't know exactly how much money is spent on students and how much is spent on specific faculties. We can look into that for you if you would like. But in total, we do know that there's about $600 to $800 million in deferred maintenance campus-wide. So that's including all the campuses. That's Augustana, that's Campus St. Jean, that's South Campus, that's North Campus. So what we're really pushing for is there's a mix of different infrastructure funding. So when it comes down to deferred maintenance, there's lights on funding, there's capital project funding, there's new project funding. And what we're pushing for is kind of a mix of all of those. When I had my meeting with the VP of Facilities and Ops, he was bringing up this really interesting idea. He wants to involve experiential learning with deferred maintenance. That's one of the things that the university is really interested in. So one of the things that they're looking at is using some of the buildings here on campus as kind of case study projects. So they were, you know, doing a research project on how to make, say, Cameron Library more energy efficient, and how to reduce greenhouse gases coming out of Butternut. So hopefully we can mix that in with the way that we advocate. That way we are helping students by providing them research opportunities during their degree, and in addition to that, we are helping solve the deferred maintenance problems that are going on throughout the institution. Does that answer the question?
Kind of.
If you want more information, just give me a shout and then I'll try and help you out.
Thank you very much. We'll go next to Councillor Larson.
Right on. Just the first question is, I'll do this one first. In your guys' expenditures, and the most recent one, and in several others as well, moves to budget no more than $4,000 to send President, VP, External, and DP, RA to the Council Advocacy Week conference in Ottawa. I'll direct this question, I guess, at President Ramon. What is DPRA, just for curiosity? Like, I tried Googling it, and there's like 18 of those acronyms, so it'd be nice just to get a little clarification.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I have a question, Councillor Larson. My personal preference is actually DERPA.
Ah!
But what the acronym stands for, I think, is what you're asking, not how I say it. It's the Director of Research and Political Affairs, also known as the member known as John Mastel.
Oh,
by the Student Union. Yes.
Oh! Okay.
And he'll be attending the conference to give us a lot of help in our preparation for meetings with MPs and other government staffers on the Hill.
Thank you very much. We'll go next to Councillor Christensen.
This is a question for Councillor Flamin. I was wondering if the member could explain why CAC hasn't met in 6 weeks, building on my earlier question.
Thank you for the question. If I recall, the last couple meetings were canceled because there wasn't anything on the agenda. I can't pull that off on the current committee chair because we don't have one, but to the best of my recollection, that's what it was for.
Thank you very much, Councillor Flamin. We'll go next to Councillor Farouk.
This is for Vice President Art. Would you be able to expand on what the MFES committee or panel will do, and its and who the members will consist of, councillors and otherwise?
So when it comes down to the advisory committee for MFES, what I'm doing is I'm mixing folks from different university departments, SU employees, and students. So the idea is, with MFES, I've already been reaching out to different departments, such as alumni relations and University of Alberta International and the Career Centre, because these are major stakeholders with student employment on campus. So I do want to make sure that the voice of stakeholders who do have to do with student employment is mixed with students on this council. And in addition to that, I'm trying to open up one or two, depending on how the applications go, spots for external bodies as well. So I'm looking at businesses in the community, because hopefully they can give insight on, you know, how best to provide students with employment. When it comes down to the roles of the committee, it's going to be an advisory committee, so we'll be running things through them, such as event applications, looking at speakers for the events, outreach and marketing. So just kind of trying to figure out, you know, how best to reach students on campus from the perspective of stakeholders in different areas.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. We'll go next to Councillor Monda.
All right, so I have a question for Vice President Gauthier.
So it was a great overview of residents' history and context in the presentation, but I'm just wondering if you could give council a summary of the state of representation in other residents' communities other than Lister as it stands now.
Okay, so other than Lister, the residents' associations have been quite nervous and frustrated since the fee collection. There's a lot of echo in my mic. Since the fee collection took so much time to happen, basically, and it still hasn't happened, but at least we have a confirmation that it will. They were unable to appropriately budget for their activities for the rest of the year, and were basically expecting minimal income and budgeting on that, based on that. So I think that issue has greatly affected their ability to deliver services this semester, and I hope that them getting the fees will help them accomplish their goals as they were expecting to in the upcoming semesters. I hope that this wouldn't be an issue for next year. Unfortunately, just so that council knows, there is some residences such as Mishner Park or Noon Place that will not be getting association fees because they were not included in the board motion that was presented to the Board of Governors at the end of last year, and that's because predominantly these residences host graduate students, and the students' union doesn't have the authority to levy fees from graduate students. So that's something that, you know, the Graduate Students Association is working on, as I understand it. We hope to find, you know, a way forward with them so that graduate students in those particular residences are able to contribute to residence association budgets.
Thank you very much. We'll go next to Councillor Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. This is for Vice President Academic. I'm just wondering, you mentioned in your report the PLC Oversight Committee and reviewing and potentially rewriting the committee's terms of reference. I'm just curious as to, is there any problems with the terms of reference, or is this just for fun?
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, and thank you, Councillor Larson. That is a simple question with not a simple answer. So this is the first meeting of the PLC Oversight Committee with the expanded membership. That includes now myself, a faculty person, administrator person from Camden St. John, Augustana, as well as Ailes. So because of that expanded membership, we're taking that time to reflect on if the committee is still fulfilling its perceived and real mandate, and if that needs to be changed in any sort of way. So, at first, we were looking at reviewing the terms of reference, but now we're actually looking at rewriting them. So that will be coming to me in the next week or so, and I'd be happy to provide council with a further update at that time. As you guys know, terms of reference are kind of like the rule book to which the game is played, the game of governance. So if the terms of reference change, then that may mean that the committee changes, which would be pretty significant considering the PLC Oversight Committee is tasked with lots of responsibilities. So, happy for follow-up questions if people want more info.
Thank you very much, Vice President Bannister. So with that question and answer, our first 15 minutes of question period has elapsed. Council can extend the question period by an additional 15 minutes with a show of 5 placards. To give you some information, I currently have 3 individuals on the speaker's list. It looks like 5, so we'll continue with the next 15 minutes, starting with Councillor Christensen. Go ahead.
Okay,
Just another question regarding the Council Administration Committee. Given that it hasn't met in 6 weeks, I was just wondering if, is it because there nothing needs to be done? Are there no projects underway, none of its mandates that need to be filled? Because I know other committees have been meeting and they have much smaller mandates. So and this is directed to Councillor Flamin as the senior member of CAC, as I was informed earlier. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, and thank you for the question. Going back through old minutes, I was only appointed to the committee one meeting. I've only been to one meeting since I was appointed. So I'm trying to go back through old minutes and kind of glean some information as to what some goals and stuff were from way back when. And some things, and this is far from a comprehensive list, but some things that were mentioned earlier in the year that want to be accomplished, hopefully before the end of the year, are some FA town halls. We had some last year, and they seem to be quite a success. We'd like to have those again, which kind of goes hand in hand with increasing engagement and increasing the presence of council, which we might toss around the idea of doing something for ASLS before the deadline. Review the performance of the CRO now that we've had a by-election and under our belt, we can kind of see if there needs to be anything tweaked. Attendance policy was mentioned, but that's largely done. Now we might be able to, pending the amendments that may or may be coming towards that, try and apply that to committees themselves. Council para for the most part is done. Now we just need to get those out to the new councillors. And that's all I have for the moment. But I'll keep looking and get back to you later.
Thank you very much. We'll go next to Councillor Monda.
I have a question for Vice President Bannister. So in your report, you mentioned the GFC Committee on the Learning Environment and the review of the USRI course evaluations. So I've seen a lot of media coverage lately surrounding the USRIs, both on campus and off campus. And there's been a lot of discussion over whether these are a fair tool of evaluation for instructors. So I'm just wondering if you could expand on this discussion that occurred and what next steps the university might be taking on course evaluations. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, and thank you, Councillor Monda. So one of the committees I sit on is called CLE, which is the Committee of Learning Environment. Is the first word? Is the C in committee? Okay, yes. Yeah, so Committee of Learning Environment. There's so many acronyms. So CLE, and it's tasked with looking into how professor evaluations go, if it should stay the same, if it should change, the whole gamut. We're investigating, we're looking into it. So in the governance community, there's very little consensus on anything, but there's consensus that we are probably not asking the right questions all the time. So people don't know. Basically, every class of the semester, you fill out a USRI, which provides feedback for your professor, and that feedback is used in many ways, including on faculty evaluation committees, which decides if your professor gets like a merit-based pay increase. So that would be one example of how that feedback is used. So we're looking into a couple things on the committee. We're looking into if we should be using the technology of USRI or if we should be changing that to a different technology. And B, we're looking into what are the questions we're asking? Are they the right questions? And are we getting enough context for those questions? And then C, how that feedback is being used. So those are the three main areas we're investigating. Currently, the CTL, which is the Center for Teaching and Learning, is creating a survey, which they're going to talk. This is the boring part right now, but it's actually secretly exciting, so listen hard, folks. So CTL is creating a survey, which they're going to send to department chairs and be like, yo, department chair, like, do you care about USRIs? Yeah? Nah? Like, explain. Bah. And we're hoping to get that feedback and use it to make an informed decision on how to move forward. So we're not just like unilaterally working, because that has proven to be ineffective in the past. So that's updates as per now. Happy to provide updates in the future, and if you have more questions on specifically what's going on, for example, what questions we're liking, what questions we're not liking, blah, 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 et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, please let me know.
Thank you very much, Vice President Bannister. We'll go next to Councillor Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Seeing as we're going to have a bylaw, first principles coming up on CEEF and the terms and references and all those fun things on that, I would like if either our President, Mr. Rahman, or our Vice President Patches could expand on what CEEF is and its mandate.
I'll direct that question to Vice President Patches.
Thank you, Councillor Larson. So we'll introduce the specific motion once we have time for that. However, CEEF is the Student Involvement Endowment Fund, and it is a portfolio of investments that the Students' Union utilizes in multiple different kinds of low-risk investments, such as low-risk mutual funds as well as bond options, that the Students' Union utilizes to create funding for awards and other scholarship opportunities that we offer. So that those investments are yearly pulled from that to give to awards, and then that money is then made back through the investments as best as possible. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We'll go next to Councillor Christensen.
Thank you. This is a question for President Rahman. I was just wondering if he could explain when it comes to project allocation, how the exec kind of assesses what projects that ought to be funded every year, and decides how this budget line is allocated each year using student dollars to pay for some of these projects. I'm just wondering, is there some type of system that's put in place, or is it just the first come, first serve, how that's really decided? Because it seems a little abstract to me, and I just would love to learn more.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, and thank you, Councillor Christensen, for the question, not Councillor Christian. So the PA allocation budget is determined or designed to accommodate for any big requests that come up throughout the year that can't be integrated into the budget principles in March when we approve the Mass Students Council. I'd say the primary thing that I look for as Students Union Presidents is relevance to the platform that the executives campaign on, just because the executives do campaign on things that are really relevant for students, and students voice that with their support for a democratically elected executive. And I don't think it's my place to say, no, you shouldn't fund your campaign promise. I think that students' decisions with their votes should be respected like that. So that's the primary thing that I do look at. Now, if you take a look at the executives this year, there are some executives that are definitely running more financially requiring projects than some other executives. I know for myself, I'm not intending to use too much of the PA because I don't have a good reason to, but if you take a look at VP Patches, for example, he's running a $10 million project, and there's no way in heck that we could run that through the PA, but if there's a role for the PA to support that project of renovating the Margaret Theater, then I'm all for it. So those are the primary factors that I look at, but of course we want to make sure that we're using our money as stingily as possible, just because it's not an infinite pot of money. The other thing that I'll add is that at the beginning of the year, usually within the first two or three months of the semester, at one of our executive retreats, we all get together and we say, look, if you cut the PA into five would be, everyone gets about $10,000. And we say, if you had $10,000 to work on your campaign projects, how would you allocate it? And that's what we really use as our template. It's not a binding template, but it's a draft template for how we expect to spend our money throughout the year. And when additional projects come up that we don't expect, we say, is someone willing to take a hit on some of their projects that they allocate at the beginning of the semester to fund something that has come up that's high priority that we need to invest in pursuits?
Thank you very much. We'll go next to Councillor Manda.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I have another question for Vice President Bannister. So for the University Writing Center consultations, do we know what kind of triggered the university to review these services? Because to an outsider, from my position, it kind of seems like they kind of came out of nowhere. And secondly, in your opinion, what do you think would be the ideal outcome of these consultations?
Thank you, Councillor Mona, and thank you, Mr. Speaker. I'll answer the second part of your question, but I don't know the answer to the first, so I may be deferring to President Roman. In the second part, for the ideal outcomes, we're looking out ultimately for student interests. A lot of these discussions, for better or for worse, have been surrounding HR and a lot of the legality of the potential move. And that, in our opinion, doesn't directly impact the service for students. As long as the person's qualified to hold the position where they're controlling how it goes, we're happy with that. Our ideal outcome is that the quality of the service or services remains, and the quality remains extremely high for students who use those services. We don't want to see any job opportunities lost for student tutors, as that is an employment source for some of our students on campus. And we also want to see it remain affordable and accessible. So right now there's a spectrum between the Center for Writers and Student Success Centers of paid services and free services, and we want to make sure that it's affordable and accessible to students, whether that be retaining the existing spectrum or increasing the variety of low-cost or free options. So as long as those main pillars are retained, we're quite happy with however that comes out in the formation of the administration of the services. So that will be what I'm primarily looking for in the upcoming consultations. That said, I don't know what exactly sparked this change, so maybe President Roman will have that information.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, and thank you, Vice President Academic, for tossing that over to me. My understanding of what spurred this discussion in the first place is the fact that I believe it was last year, I'm not sure if it's still the case now, but last year the Center for Writers was a budget line within the Faculty of Arts. But the thing is, that's not a service exclusively for art students. And I think that there was a bit of an issue that if the service is housed in the Faculty of Arts, that means it's primarily for art students, which isn't true at all. Essentially, the Dean of Arts wanted to defer the budget line over to the Dean of Students, so that would be more accessible to all students on campus. But the Dean of Students isn't necessarily in a position to take on. They might have some changes to the administration of the service if we were to go into the portfolio. And then my understanding is that members of the committee got concerned with what those changes could like and how that could impact the service for students, which is what led us to the consultation process we're in right now.
Thank you very much. We'll go next to Councillor Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. This question is for our Vice President General, Sandari. I'm not sure if I saw it somewhere, if it just slipped my memory, but what is the approximate cost going to be for MFest?
I'll just go anyways. So when it comes down to MFest, I'm looking at the different scales. So at the very, very least, I'm looking at somewhere around what Gov costs, so somewhere between like $4,000 to $5,000, but I'm also looking into sponsorship. So I'm looking to see if we could partner with different companies, if we're able to grab funding from different university departments as well as partners, with different companies in the city. So if possible, I would like to see it be around $15,000, but that again depends on sponsorship. So if we're not able to get there, then a smaller event is still something that I'm planning for. I'm just planning it in different scales with different like prices of speakers and different levels of events that would be happening. So, yeah. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there any further questions for question period? Seeing none, close question period there. We'll move on to board and committee business. Just before we get into item 7A, just want to let council know that item 7C will be special ordered onto the main agenda. Yes, for those people who are paying attention, it does require for someone to make a motion to suspend standing orders to allow a motion to be debated upon in the same meeting in which a presentation was completed on the same topic. But I will let members of council take care of that in due course. If no such motion comes up, 7C will be postponed to the next meeting of Students' Council. So we'll go to item 7A. Mon Patches move to approve the first readings of Bill Number 9 to clarify the role of the Student Involvement Endowment Fund, also known as SEEF. 1. the Student Involvement Endowment Fund has been used to support specific initiatives for the Students' Union. Two, the Student Involvement Endowment Fund has grown in scope since it was conceived in bylaw. Three, these changes have been described in the current objectives of the society. Four, bylaw 3000 shall be amended to reflect these changes. President Rahman, would you like to introduce? Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. So we talked a little bit about CFIP in the question period, but essentially, I'll give you guys some more history on what CFIP is. So I think way back in 2009, 2010, our VP Operations and Finance at the time, Zach Fentiman, essentially said, hey, we give out awards on a regular basis. Is there a way to take the money that we do use for awards and find a way to do it in a more sustainable way? And because of that, we created CFIP. Now, CFIP was operating pretty well, and it continues to operate pretty well. But around 2014, our then Vice President Academic, Catherine Hortzik, took a look at CFIP and said, you know, we do renovations on a semi-regular, consistent basis. We did renovations to the atrium, or the really open study staircase that a lot of students use right now. We're planning on doing renovations to the Meyer Horowitz Theater. Why don't we open up CFIP to include other capital projects such as that? And so the objectives of the Student Involvement Endowment Fund have grown in scope because of the changes that Catherine Hortzik proposed and were approved by the executive at the time. And basically, we want to make sure that those objectives are reflected within Students' Union bylaw, because Students' Union bylaw hasn't been updated to be reflected of those changes. So that's really all that this motion is trying to do. It's a very small one. I brought it to bylaw hoping that it could be an editorial change. It wasn't considered an editorial change, which is why I'm here today, and I'm more than happy to answer any other questions about what's on my table right now. That's all from me.
Thank you very much. Open the floor to debate. If any members of council, sorry, I probably should have specified this earlier, if any members of council would like to participate in debate, you have a microphone in front of you. There is a little symbol there that looks like a person speaking, or what I like to call like the Bluetooth symbol. Press that button. You'll be put on the speaker's list, which appears on this wonderful screen that I have in front of me. We'll go in the order in which people press that button, basically. You have 4 minutes per speaking turn and 2 speaking turns per motion. If we get to amendments and things like that, the 2 speaking turns kind of start over, basically. But we'll get to that, cross that bridge when we come to it. So we'll start with Councillor Christians. Go ahead.
I just had a question regarding the allocation of the money that comes out of here. Is it subject to approval, like if money is being taken out of it or at any point, is it subject to the approval of Student Council, or is that something that's made by the foundation itself, by the exec, a combination of both, or neither? If that could just be clarified.
Thank you very much. Are there any further questions for item 7A, or points of debate? Vice President Patches, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Two things I would do. First off, I'll address the question to Councillor Christensen. So currently, disbursements are approved by Finance Committee. That being said, the only disbursement that happens out of CFIP currently is the poll for awards funds. And that's literally been the only time that CFIP has ever been polled. So I'd just like to add another point onto what President Rahman said, is the reason that we'd like to do this, the reason we're bringing this forward today is we'd like to see CFIP having more possibility. And I'd like to just provide the, I have the objectives of the society here just for Council's information. Number one is to promote the advancement of education by the provision of scholarships, bursaries, or other financial assistance for students of merit and distinction at the University of Alberta in Edmonton. Two, to make grants and awards of scholarships for meritorious achievements or otherwise. Three, to contribute funds to projects that will benefit students in the University of Alberta. Four, to receive acquirements of gifts, donations, legacies, and devices which may be conducive to the objectives of the society. And five, to undertake and execute any trust training conducive to any of the foregoing objectives of the society.
Thank you very much, Vice President Patches. Are there any further items of debate for item 7A? Council Farouk, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, and thank you for to President Rahman and Vice President Patches. Just looking at this and looking at the CFIP mandate, essentially, I don't quite necessarily see this as being a small change, just because it is such a large amount of money within CFIP. And by potentially enacting this bill, we open up CIF and the money within CIF to more than scholarships, and that's quite a large jump. And my question kind of bounces off Councillor Christensen's in terms of the approval process and the oversight for the management of this money, because essentially apart from the scholarship, the only thing that's really done with CIF, to my understanding, is that, you know, there are investments done with it to increase the endowment fund in of itself. So I'm wondering if within this bill there's going to be additional additions for oversight about how the money is used, how the money is allocated. Because while currently we can say that we're really only using this for capital projects, and that's not really, and like, while that's not really set in stone at the moment, is that something we use it for? This is based on what's happening within the SU. It's not like written in stone. My only concern really is that you open stuff now. We can use it for like capital projects like the renovations today, but like, you know, down the line, I think it can also be open for mismanagement or maybe improper management of improper use of funds. And with that oversight from not just finance committee, just because it's just a single committee, but like maybe like reporting to council, having a lot more extensive budgeting process that's reviewed by multiple parties, whether it be directly to Students Council, the VP Operations Finance, and the other parties, just so it's a lot more accountable. That's essentially what I would like to see, just have the oversight and the accountability, just because it is a large amount of money. And CIF's mandate itself, like to benefit students, while that's a good thing, it's for me, it's very open-ended, and has too much potential for, you know, for mismanagement. Because you can really convince me that anything is good for students. Like, you can convince me that building a giant water slide and stuff is a good idea, sure, why not. But like, that doesn't mean what's going to be spending money on it. So that's really my only concern, is having that oversight and that accountability, just so there's like a review process as to what the money's being spent for. And it's not just being discussed within the ESU's office, because discussing with your staff members, there's inherently, like, they can inherently be a lack of discussion just because people have been working on it, and they can be groupthink, basically. And I'm just rambling at this point, so I'm going to stop. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We'll go next to Councillor Larson.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. I'm curious as to what the process after this first principles is going to look like. If it's going to be a copy and paste of the objectives of the society as I see them, the opportunity for these funds to be used outside of just awards does grow, as I will echo, grows substantially. It actually completely changes the relationship that our students' union has with the CIF fund and its original purpose, which was to provide scholarships. Now, I do understand fully that there is quite a bit of money sitting there that can go to better uses, such as renovating. But I would like to echo the fact that simply bringing in these mandates directly into our own bylaws, in Bylaw 3000, would not guarantee the level of oversight I'd be comfortable with this fund particularly, especially seeing as it is particularly for the scholarships that we are supposed to be providing. So, although this will come to bylaw and we can hash that out there, I do believe it would be important to have it reflected in first principles, possibly along the lines that any expenditures, large or small, that come out of the CIF fund do go through an approval process. I understand that the inherent answer to that is that it will go through finance, but because of the scale of many of the things that will be pulled out of CIF, I would imagine, renovations being one of them, I do believe it would be important for council to be involved in that conversation.
Thank you. much, Councillor Larson. We'll go next to President Rahman.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. So I think the feedback that I'm starting to get from a few members of council right now is the fact that there is a large pot of money within CEEP at the moment, and there isn't necessarily the oversight that's required for it. Now, I, as an executive, am quite happy with the oversight that's provided within CEEP, but if council says that there needs to be more oversight, I'm more than happy to include that. I don't think that this bill right now is intended to change the oversight mechanism, because I personally didn't have any concerns with the oversight mechanism. But if council believes that there is an issue, I would welcome you all to bring up bill to Students' Council or bylaw committee and take a look at the current oversight mechanism. Like, I personally am okay with things going to Finance Committee because we do have representatives of Students' Council. It's not the executive or the staff making all the decisions. We know that Council is the final approval. Council has delegates and the final approval to Finance Committee, which has representatives from Students' Council. But if that isn't sufficient, then I would favorably want another bill that takes a look at the oversight mechanism. Now, you can have a guarantee from the executive that we won't be spending any money on CEEP this semester beyond what it typically is used for. So I wouldn't be too worried about approving this and then the executives or the staff going right away to find devious reasons for spending this money. But if you're concerned about the oversight, I think that there is time before the intention is to spend some of this money for the Marlborough renovations to take a look at the oversight mechanisms and revise them before any decisions are made on the renovations.
Thank you very much, President Rahman. We'll go back to Councillor Larson.
I'm going to respectfully disagree. The only oversight mechanism for this fund at the moment is this single line in bylaw that says CEEP must be spent on scholarships and in grants and or bursaries. So for us to change that in any way actually does completely change the oversight commitment that originally was written into bylaw. So I would say that although we would obviously have councillors and members of council on all of our committees, that bylaw is the ultimate judge and or oversight mechanism that has been placed on CEEP. So if we're going to change that, that does completely change how we have any sort of structure of oversight. Now, if we want to completely rattle the cage and see if we need an entire new mechanism for CEEP, such as maybe a CEEP committee in and of itself, we can do that, but that does feel out of scope. I will leave that there and see if anybody else has any other comments or concerns.
Thank you very much. We'll go next to Vice President Patches.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. So just in the context of today's discussion, I'll just echo comments on the end here very clearly about the need for an oversight, and I completely agree that's very important, especially when we're dealing with reserves. And currently with multiple reserves, the Students Union, we're not able to pull any kind of funds from that reserve unless we come to council. For example, the capital equipment reserve, you cannot pull funds from that unless you come directly to council. An example last year was the upgrades to printing facilities at subgrants that needed to be approved by council. So taking that precedent, and then as well as another reserve I'm looking at right now, 0.6 in the reserves bylaw in bylaw 3000 of the capital advocacy reserve, I see subpoints underneath there giving some pull limits as well as the oversight needed for each of those limits. And I think taking those kind of considerations into account, I'm still comfortable with what's on the table today as far as the first principles. And I'm also confident that these issues have been communicated, that once we go through the second principles, we can make those amendments within bylaw 3000 to include those pieces of oversight. And I welcome everyone who's brought concerns on these oversight steps to come and assist us in making sure that those necessary oversight steps are taken.
Thank you very much. Is there any further debate on item 7A? Go to Councillor Monda.
To kind of expand on some of the concerns I'm hearing with some of my own. I know that it's only first principles, but it seemed from what I'm not super knowledgeable about CEEP, so this is just my best guess, but it sounds like it's only been used so far for a scholarship funding, and I think that, and this suggestion seems to be that it could also be used for things like capital projects like the Meyer Horowitz renovation as a current example. So I'm just thinking that maybe there should be something in first principles that's more specific than specific initiatives, maybe saying that the C fund has been used to will be used to support like scholarship funding as well as capital projects, because specific initiatives is extremely vague.
Thank you very much. Councilor Larson, do you have an amendment you would like to make to the motion? Or you would like to make a motion?
I'll leave it for now. Let's let the debate continue. I apologize.
Is there any further debate on item 7A? Council Ferg.
Okay. I just want to get my brain together just because all of a sudden I didn't really think it's true. But I'm just trying to think of what potential oversight mechanisms that we can have. And feasibility discussing them just ad hoc at the moment, I don't see those being very productive. I was going to be here for three more hours, which also I also don't recommend. One or two said I am a little bit nervous. But it's off the top of my head as oversight mechanisms. Obviously, this is going through finance. And the changes coming to this, I would recommend highly that there be comprehensive budgeting done for the C fund and how it is allocated and the approval process for that as well. Obviously, at the start of the approval process, whether it goes to finance, goes to the different departments within the SCU, if it goes to council itself after it crosses a certain amount of money that's being used, which is not a bad idea, actually. And then, whether this board is not as part of just the general statements and finances, or whether it's audited, and et cetera, et cetera. So there's a lot to talk about there. And I don't see us correctly doing that at council right now. And seeing as, as far as I can tell, this isn't time sensitive. So it may be more productive for us to go send this back to bylaw and attach it out there, and then bring them back next time and see how that works. Obviously, I'm not on the bylaw, so I can't make the decisions for them. So if any committee members want to chip in and share their opinions on whether or not that's a good idea, be open to it. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Councilor Farouk. We'll go next to Councilor Monda.
I would like to move to refer this motion to bylaw committee.
Is there a seconder for this motion, Councilor Farouk? Just double check. All right. So, according to Robert's rules, this motion is debatable, is amendable, and requires just a simple majority. So, Councilor Mondo, would you like to introduce why you believe this should be referred back to committee?
Well, we've had a lot of good discussion here so far, but I don't think council is the right place to make these potential changes to the first principles, because I think they are too complex to manage through amendments while the bill is on the floor. So for that reason, I feel it is appropriate to refer the motion to bylaw committee.
Thank you very much. We'll start debate with President Rahman.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I'd like to speak in favor of this motion just because I think that there are some tinkering to bylaw 3000 that can be done, and I'm glad that members of council brought their concerns today. I think it's better to deal with those concerns at committee, as Councilor Mann noted, but I'm a little disappointed in bylaw members just because I did give a week's notice to
getting it today at the meeting when I had time to get that feedback in advance. And I did get feedback from the Sunbury Group model, but these concerns did come specifically. So I wish I had a bit more advance notice, but I'm more than happy to take time if that's what council wishes.
Thank you very much. Is there any further debate on this motion? So just a quick clarification for those people who have not come across this motion before. What this motion would do effectively is send this item, item 7A, back to, would send this to bylaw committee, I should say back to bylaw committee, to discuss any potential opposition or fix any problems that members of council might have with the motion as it is currently worded, and then subsequently bylaw can choose to bring this motion back to Students Council for further consideration. Hopefully that's clear as mud. Any other items of debate for this motion? Seeing none, is there anyone opposed to carrying this motion? Would anyone like to abstain from the motion? Does everyone understand what an abstention is just before we? If anyone doesn't, that's okay. Just tell me now. That's cool. All right, so that motion carries unanimously, and item 7A will be referred back to the bylaw committee. So we've already dealt with item 7B, so we'll move on to item 7C. Yes, Councilor.
Can I make a motion to suspend standing order so we can discuss item 7C at this meeting?
Is there a seconder for this motion? Wonderful. Motion to suspend the rules is not debatable, not amendable, and requires a two-thirds majority. So for the first time in this meeting, we'll use our handy voting system. So for those people who have not used this before, above the person who is speaking, you'll see three buttons. You'll see a plus, a zero, and a minus. A plus is a vote in favor, a zero is an abstention, and a minus is a vote against. So to clarify again what this motion would do, according to standing orders, you cannot have a presentation and a motion on the same topic occur in the same meeting. So this would effectively allow Council to consider a motion to approve the Students Union audit report upon the recommendation of the audit committee. Does anyone have any questions about that before we go to vote? Seeing none, please vote now. Voting will close in 3, 2, 1. That motion carries with 25 in favor, 2 opposed, and 1 abstention. So we'll go to item 7C. Councillor Hammond, seconded by Councillor Aldamori, move to approve the Students Union audit report upon the recommendation of the audit committee. Councillor Hammond, would you like to introduce? Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. So I believe the bulk of the information was delivered in the presentation, but just to summarize, this was the first presentation delivered about KPMG's audit findings. And so just to reiterate, there was no major discrepancies in the financial reporting that they identified other than a minor misclassification of investment income in the CEF, which was corrected. And so the implication of voting in favor of this audit report is that the signed auditor statement can be attached to the financial reports, and the financial reports can be released in a timely manner. So thanks very much.
Thank you very much. Is there any debate on item 7C? Seeing none, is there anyone opposed to carrying item 7C? Would anyone like to abstain from the motion and have their abstention noted? Awesome. So that motion carries unanimously. So with that out of the way, there's a few information items. If you have not already had a chance to read them, I certainly suggest you do. And a reminder to all the members of the Council Administration Committee, should have a quick meeting right away here after Council is done. 5 minutes? So we'll quickly take attendance. We'll give Council a fair bit of time to leave, and then Council Administration Committee can get started with their business. Again, Council would like to stay for this particular vote and provide information. Feel free to do so. You're all members of the Council Administration Committee. So we'll go back to our handy attendance sheets and take attendance very quickly. President Rahman.
Here.
Vice President Bannister.
Present.
Vice President Sundari.
Hello.
Vice President Patches.
Here.
Vice President Hussein.
Present.
Governor Chopin. Councilor McKinley.
Here.
Councilor, proxy for Councilor Angus.
Here.
Councilor Kiani.
Here.
Councilor Datiowa.
Here.
Councilor Monda.
Here.
Councilor Larson.
Here.
Councilor Victoria Dion.
Here.
Councilor Yim.
Here.
Councilor Hammond.
Here.
Proxy for Councilor Al-Muri.
Here.
Councilor Prasad.
Here.
Councilor Pratnow.
Here.
Councilor Nahi.
Here.
Councilor Nick Dion. Councilor Hashim.
Here.
Councilor Brophy.
Here.
Councilor Christensen.
Here.
Councilor Sunday.
Here.
Councilor Scott.
Present.
Councilor Flamin.
Here.
Councilor Kwan.
Here.
Councilor Howie.
Present.
Councilor Warrior.
Here.
Councilor Newman. Councilor Nguyen. Councilor Mahal. Councilor Farouk.
Here.
Councilor Rachel. Councilor Wan. Proxy to Councilor Kim. I'm here. Be adjourned at 9:17 p.m.
Actually, I was the screen. I was the